meeting of the Joint Armed Services Committee to order. Record reflect it is 1:10 on Tuesday, June 25th. We got a full house today. Members present today, Co-Chair Kelly, Senator Kelly, Senator Dyson, Senator Faircloth, Senator Conkill, Senator Willikowski, Representative Feige is online, Representative Isaacson, Representative Lynn, Representative Tarr, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Sadler. Public members present with us today, Lieutenant General Retired Tom Case, Major General Retired Jake Lestenkoff, Brigadier General Retired George Canellis, and Colonel Retired Tim Jones is online. And we may be standing by for a few more folks to come online. I would look for other legislators, seeing none, but I do see Mayor Hopkins from North Starboro. Welcome, Mayor. And I would advise us all to kill our cell phones because they can make fun noises and make things interesting for the secretary later. Oh, goodness, on this sunny day, glad to see everybody here. Before we start the meeting, I'd like to give a little bit of background for the members of the audience and people listening online. The Joint Armed Services Committee was established back in the 90s in response to one of the first Base Realignment and Closure Commission rounds. I know that Lieutenant Colonel Chris Nelson remembers those days well. Comprised of 5 senators, 5 representatives, and 6 public members, with a mission to monitor and address potential realignments of military facilities in Michigan, Alaska, to advocate for the National Missile Defense System here in Alaska, to seek out ways to attract new missions to Alaska bases, and to support increased joint military training in our state. Our mission is especially important and timely as the country faces some tremendous budget pressures brought about by the planned budget reductions, by forced reduction and strategic reorientation towards the Pacific Theater, the process of budget sequestration, the possibility of future black rounds, and the threat of hollowing out of Alaska forces, as we've seen with the proposed transfer of F-16s out of Eielson to J-Bear. It's important for everyone to keep in mind that Alaska's military services and agencies are essential for national defense, for force projection, for joint training and preparedness, the stability of our economy, and the safety of our citizens. Recognizing these facts, last year the legislature funded a contract to hire a leading national consulting firm to advise our state on how to soften the blow of any such reductions and how to take advantage of the changing defense environment to Alaska's advantage. This afternoon we'll get a presentation from that consultant, Mr. Steve Hijack of Hijack and Fix. He is joined by the QP Air Deputy Commissioner of DMVA. And there's lots of information. You do have their slides and report in front of you, but I'd like to invite Mr. Pierre to give us opening remarks to help set the stage and introduce Mr. Hijack.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to see you this wonderful summer day. I just want to pass some regards from General Kakis, first and foremost, to members of the committee. He is back at the Air National Guard at National Guard Bureau, giving the state of the state, as General Canellis is familiar with. We're pushing very hard to get an associate unit up there with the KC-135s at Eielson. That's the refueling tankers, and we have a lot of support from National Guard Bureau. We have support from PACAF, and now it's just a matter of getting AMC and Mobility Command to also support it. And we'll go into some of those details further, but it's very critical that we get all those pieces lined up so we can get more manpower running the iron we have up at Eielson, and then we can set the stage for more airplanes as well. Just a couple housekeeping notes. We do have the plan to go over, but we also have some slides to kind of show what type of environment we're in nationally. DOD is going through a historic drawdown, just like it has done through many other after-conflict times. Traditionally, you look at 25 to 30% reduction of the overall DOD budget, and the first thing to go is procurement. Obviously, basing needs is part of that as well, so that's something we'll discuss. And then finally, I've got Mr. Hijack here with me. The state is exiting the contract that we had with Hijack and Fix the company because that company is not the same company anymore. Things have changed, and at the request of the committee, we brought up Mr. Steve Hijack as the author of the report to talk about what he did working with the DMVA, working with AMFAS, and the governor's office to put together this plan that we've shared with you guys. So these are opinions of Steve Hijack, and we are going to go out for a new RFP sometime in July because the contract ended at the end of this fiscal year. So it was a good timing there as the company changed. We also had the opportunity to cancel that contract and move forward, and we'll address the new concerns, the new needs that we believe we have. We think we're on a great path forward. This plan, this idea of engaging is the right way to go, and with your help, we'll start to do even more, and we'll make a huge impact for the military community in Alaska. So with that, Mr. Chairman, let me introduce Steve Hijack and allow him to go through a couple slides with us.
Thank you, Mr. Pierre, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. First of all, I apologize that we showed up with some slides we didn't provide you in advance, and the reason why that's occurred is simply that I thought the few slides might be a good stage setter for you to understand the environment that we have in Washington, which is leading to some of the actions that we propose. I will provide these to you both electronically as well as hard copy. And again, these are not related specifically to Alaska, but primarily with regards to the DOD and budget environment in Washington. The first slide that we have up here just reviews the Budget Control Act requirements, and I would say, in the interest of full disclosure, the next five or six slides come from the Congressional Research Service. I can claim no credit for being smart enough to write all this stuff down concisely. What I wanted to provide you here was the most important point that you need to take away from this slide is that we're looking at potentially $1.2 trillion in savings between FY12 and 21 as a result of the Budget Control Act of 2011, which was enacted after the Congress and the administration could not agree on raising the debt ceiling. They laid out a process, which was under the Budget Control Act, which created a super committee. That super committee was supposed to find a way to, through revenues or savings, take care of this additional $1.2 trillion in budget requirements. When they failed to do so, that put us in the situation that we face now, which is sequestration, which, of course, you all are familiar with as a result of both the materials that you have read and news coverage. So how does sequester work? This basically sets out ceilings on an annual basis, for the period of FY13 through fiscal year 21. The two toughest years, so you need to be aware of this, are FY13, because of the fact that the Department of Defense and most agencies decided to operate and plan and execute their budget on the assumption that sequestration would not occur. Those are directions that they had in the process of management and budget.
Pardon me, go ahead online.
Thanks, Rep. Feige. Mr. Hijack said something about new slides.
Yes, sir. I have approximately 10 slides, which we will provide copies to you, sir, in the future. These are not something that anybody of the committee has today because I put them together late on Friday night, and I discussed with Mr. Pierre the idea of using them as a stage setter prior to reviewing the strategic plan.
Very well. Just be real descriptive.
Yes, sir. I apologize. I will do so. The second slide that I'm referring to is entitled How Does Sequester Work, and it's basically just describes the process. The two takeaway bullets, sir, for you to be aware of and all the members of the committee here is that the Budget Control Act requires the defense budget to find $42.7 billion in savings between April 1, 2013 and September 30th, 2013. And that goes back to what I was just articulating, which is that all of the agencies, to include DOD, who is half of the cost savings here, they were instructed to operate as though sequestration would not occur because it was not a given until we actually hit that point in time. That's now caused them to have to find a way to squeeze these savings out of the last 5 to 6 months of the fiscal year. That also means that all the defense budgetary resources are being cut by about 7 to 8%, and that's resulted in grounding of aircraft, reduction in training exercises except for those units who are training to go overseas on deployments, and so on. FY13 is a very difficult year because of the compressed time frame in which they have to execute sequestration. However, FY14 is the bottom of the trough as it pertains to cuts between now and the end of the Budget Control Act, which is FY2021. To the gentleman on the phone, you'll be glad you don't have the next slide because it's got all kinds of numbers which really don't mean much of anything except for me to highlight two numbers. For those who do have the slide in front of them, if they look at fiscal year 2014, where's the pointer here? That's a laser. There we go. These numbers right here, 475, which is the budget cap post-sequestration for defense, the percentage in change of dollars and the amount of a cut that they're going to face, those, as you can see, those are the low water numbers if you look across the board in terms of reductions. 3.4% right there. This is 7.2% only because it's being done in a six-month period. So once we get past fiscal year 2014, while there are reductions, the manner in which they will be managed by the Department of Defense and the ability to plan for them is easier for them to deal with. Let me make sure I say this as simply as I can. DOD is going to take big hits on the order of $40-plus billion this year. The President's budget that was submitted to Congress does not reflect sequestration. So as a result of that, when the Congress appropriates their defense appropriations bill at some point, they will have to make cuts to bring them down to the level of $475 billion for fiscal year 2014. And if they don't, then sequestration will come in and it will provide automatic cuts across the defense accounts. Once we get past that point, life gets slightly brighter for the Department of Defense as well as for other agencies. A point that I will reinforce later on in my presentation, the longer sequestration goes, the harder it's going to be to get rid of it. Because once we've gotten used to the pain, Congress is going to find it very, very difficult to make that process go away. This slide really, more than anything else, again, sir, I apologize, you don't have this. It's a graph chart that shows the budget ceilings for purposes of defense spending. I think the most important point of this slide is if you look at the out years, we aren't going to be way outside the norm in terms of defense spending. We're not taking a 50% reduction in defense spending. We're not taking a huge increase. You'll notice that between that blue line and the orange line, that's basically where we're going to be. So it is a difficult process to work through, but it is a manageable one. I only have a few more slides to go that you gentlemen and ladies don't have. This next slide shows budget trends and personnel impacts. Here's the most important thing, again, to take from this slide. We live in a cyclical business. We ramp up for conflicts, we ramp down, and we come back up again. DOD and the Congress have to be cognizant of the fact that as we're being squeezed right now for dollars and dollars to support personnel, to support operations, modernization that Mr. Pierre mentioned, and infrastructure, if we squeeze too tight, for an example, in a future BRAC, we're not going to be able to regain that back for when we have to ramp up the next time. So while they have to worry about their short-term budgetary problems, they also have to provide sufficient flexibility for the future. And those are some of the arguments that we will use for purposes of supporting Alaska military installations.
Mr. Rajek, a brief question, if I may. You said you were going to take questions as we go, so if there's points that members need to get illuminated on the way, just for recognition.
Yes, sir.
This is a total budget. This is inclusive of future investments, new weapon systems. This is the whole shebang.
This is modernization, operations and maintenance, infrastructure, personnel, and healthcare costs as part of that.
And is it limited just to domestic, or does it include O'Connor?
It includes overseas contingency operations as well. Again, I think the purpose of this slide is simply to give you a feel for where the various elements are that the Defense Department can cut. So, Mr. Sadler, you actually were one slide ahead of me in coming to where those are. And these give you a feel for how we anticipate future cuts to occur and spending levels. Again, the thing that I want to stress is modernization gets cut first because it's the biggest account in terms of funding. It's also the one you can most easily manage. But when you get the biggest savings, it's personnel, because once you take the cut on personnel, you save those money into the out years. So that's where you're seeing for structure reductions today, and you'll see more program cuts coming in the future. This slide really goes back to the point that I think I made a few minutes earlier, and that is this is with places where they can cut. From a Defense Department standpoint, they can do base closures, they can reduce force structure, they can cancel weapon systems. And we just saw recently the FAA, they're going to close contractor-operated towers. There was a hue and cry that came about as a result of that. That was turned around. Same thing occurred with Department of Agriculture food inspectors, where there's been significant public pressure. The administration has eased back. But the administration pitched sequestration as the sky is falling. Everything is going to go haywire when we hit April 1st and sequestration hits. It has not happened. And so what occurs is now Congress has the ability, number one, to say all the dire consequences that were promised by the administration didn't occur. We don't have any reason to believe that some of the other dire consequences they project will occur will actually happen. And, oh, by the way, the further and further we go into living under sequestration and the fewer emergencies that occur, the harder it's going to be to stop this train going down the track. At least until you have a new administration, at least for the remainder of the Obama administration. Again, please feel free anytime to stop and ask any questions. For purposes, again, of illustration, I think the most important part I wanted to articulate here is that if you look at the slide, 203,000 flying hour reductions. This is the part about aircraft being parked. These are both operational as well as training aircraft. You see significant reductions in terms of operations and maintenance. Operations and maintenance is in terms of taking care of facilities, but also training. So we've had impacts with regard to red flag exercises, for example, here in Alaska. And then the training backlog, once you get to a point where you are no longer training on a regular cycle, you have two issues. You have a near-term readiness issue, which your ability to deploy quickly and efficiently, go out and do your job, but then you have the catch-up that you have to make afterwards. So if tomorrow the spigot turned back on, you still have a 3 to 6 month time lag before you can get yourself back up to the readiness ratings that you as a field commander would want to have. So we're feeling the pinch, I think, is the bottom line. And certainly from the Department of Defense's perspective, if I could put this in simple terms, they're looking at a $1.2 billion defense cut in terms of spending. They're looking at well over 130,000 personnel reduction, which could go higher if sequestration remains in place, and a 0% reduction in infrastructure, where they feel that they have 23.5% excess infrastructure based on the 2005 BRAC calculations, where they said they had 24%, and they only got rid of 0.5% of infrastructure. And this was a message that was articulated time and time again at the recent Association Defense Community meetings in Washington that Chairman Sadler and Mr. Pierre were in attendance at. A couple of just quick things with regards to the Air Force and the Army, big presences here in the state of Alaska, and frankly the biggest drivers behind the desire for a BRAC within the administration. This, by the way, this slide comes from Ms. Ferguson, the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Installations and Logistics and Environment. What's the message here? It's a big business. They got a lot of assets. So it takes a lot of money to manage this, and there's a lot of moving parts. And so they have to find ways to be more efficient, whether that's cutting, concepts like shared services, which we'll talk about a little bit later, reducing impacts, charging fees. They have to find a way to reduce the cost to run their physical plant, which is huge. The Air Force, as part of looking to the future, and I have to give them credit, frankly, on this. They're ahead of the Army on this. I think the Army is going to catch up. They are now looking beyond the physical encroachment that we tend to think of. Buildings up against the fence line, windmill turbines that impact flight operations at aircraft. They are now looking at things like spectrum. Do we have a problem with radio wavelengths that we wish to use that are clogged up by others? How are we doing with regards to water, wastewater treatment, other kinds of impacts? And there are 16 criteria that they have developed in something called, oh, she's got all kinds of beautiful sub-slides. Here we go, called ICEMAP. ICEMAP is the Installation Complex Encroachment Management Action Plans. This is the Air Force's working with the base civil engineer and the commander to identify the 16 areas where we have potential or could have potential issues in the currently or in the future in terms of airspace management, all those other things that I mentioned before. And the Army is looking to replicate this capability. The Air Force is only about a year into it, and I think that they've done on the order of 10 installations where an ice map has been actually constructed for those installations. They picked installations where they knew there was known encroachment, physical encroachment, and wanted to see what extended beyond that. We do not have any ice map plans at this stage in time for Alaska. That's a good news.
Question.
By the way, I think the other point I would also make, if I could, sir, one last point is I put a little quote here. This is not your mother's encroachment. I mean, this is where they're going to the future, and that's not just the seen but the unseen. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Representative Isaacson. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, it's good to meet you in person, finally, after having served on the mayor's Tiger team all these past years as a mayor. And so you're aware of our joint land use planning in the borough. How does this, or how does our JLUS coincide with this or help supplement that in respect to Eielson and saving Eielson?
Absolutely. Let me say that you have JLUS is for both Army and Air Force installations. The Army has a program called ACUB, the Army Compatibility Use Buffer Program, that allows them to be able to look at how they manage potential future encroachment, land acquisitions, and so on. The JLUS that you have with regards to Eielson provides you the baseline to be able to ensure that you don't have any of the physical airspace encroachments today. The JLUS will not cover some of these other new full spectrum items that are as part of ICEMAP, but it provides you a foundation well ahead of others that don't have JLUS in place. So it is a very important step to have as a foundation for managing encroachment into the future.
Follow up? So is that going to bode better for our argument to keep ILSIM, you think, or is that just supplementary out there?
I would say it certainly is a plus in the sense of the installation itself. We still have those within the Air Force from an operational and a cost standpoint that are not necessarily ILSIM fans. So it's a card in the deck that we can play. Is it the key? I would say it's not the key, but it is certainly something if we didn't have, it'd be one more item they could throw out at us. So it's a plus without a doubt. We will talk about this later on, if I could, in my briefing, but I did want to make sure you saw this as an Air Force slide. The Air Force, as part of their budget-constrained environment, is looking for ways to partner. And I know Mayor Hopkins, who's in the room here, has been very active and aggressive on this, and I applaud him for doing so. And Mr. Pierre and I had a meeting with Air Force leadership just recently with regards to community partnering. And these are going to be ways where we can create partnerships, intergovernmental partnerships, that benefit both the community and the installation. You know, we're back to Jack Kennedy. You know, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Well, the Air Force is basically in the same mode right now. What can you do to help us stay there that benefits us? Oh, and by the way, benefits you as well from a cost standpoint as well as other factors. And again, I will touch upon that later on, if I may. Do you want to offer anything on there? Okay. The Air Force has begun what they call tabletop exercises at 15 installations. These are the 15 installations that are participating in those tabletop exercises to sort of be the beta or test bed sites for shared services and partnerships. And we are working, and part of our discussions with the Air Force 2 weeks ago was to make sure that we have Alaska on the fiscal year 2014 tabletop manifest.
If I might add to that, Mr. Chairman, McHugh Pierre, for the record, that's if necessary. So the Air Force has not said that we need that as a gateway, but if necessary to help out, they can do the tabletop with us. We also know that we are well ahead of what they would normally do for a tabletop exercise. So if we continue to move along without that need, then we'll implement shared services in coordination with the borough and have state partnership with the borough in the lead. And we'll take that from the Fairbanks North Star borough and move that down here to the municipality of Anchorage to allow shared services to work here as well. So it's not just one section of the community or the state, one region that's impacted, but it's all regions that have military facilities that we can help shared service and save costs for both entities.
This might be a good time, just for the illustration purposes for members, could you give a couple examples of the kind of services that are shared with the community?
Sir, again, you beat me by a half a slide.
Good plan.
Well done. We should do this more often, Mr. Chairman.
We rehearse this, actually.
So these are some examples of the shared services that they are evaluating within the tabletop exercises that are underway. This is by no means a complete list. And by the way, you will get a copy of this for all those here, as well as the gentleman on the phone. You'll have a copy of this list. As an example, one that's not in there, which is a touchstone issue, but is one I think worth looking at, and that will be commissary services in Class 6 stores. Is that a government function that needs to be retained by the government, or is it not? Is that a way to create benefits to both the community as well as to the installation and our military community to include retirees? They have basically, the Air Force has said, you know, your only constraint are your ideas. The Air Force is a bit lower. They are just beginning to release a public policy letter. Ms. Hammack, the Assistant Secretary of the Army, indicated that her policy letter would be coming out hopefully within the next few weeks, and they hope to have guidelines for Army installation by year's end. The point of talking about shared services, as much as I have, and I will touch on it again later, this goes back to we need to be proactive in every way that we possibly can, because DOD and that budget-constrained environment that I articulated for you before, they are looking for as much help as they can in partnerships, and the more we are intertwined and partnered with each other for our benefit as well as theirs, the harder it is for them to walk away. And the less we do, the easier it is for them to say, well, we just don't have community support.
Mr. Isaac, just for the record, Representative Shelley Hughes is with us by the miracle of telecom, so she's online.
Wonderful. Thank you. We're almost done. I have three more quick slides. The last two focus specifically on BRAC and DOD's positions on it. This is from Ms. Hammack's presentation at the Association of Defense Communities. What's the big takeaway from this? I think what you need to do is look at how there's been a dramatic drop in base operation support costs. Their funding is very squeezed, and that, by the way, again, is based on the President's budget request before you cut $45 billion from the Department of Defense. So that number is going to get even smaller.
Could you do the acronym translation for us?
Okay, I will go the slide. If I start at the bottom, BOS is Base Operation Support. Other, of course, is other. MILCON is Military Construction. O&M is Operations and Maintenance. That's training, paying, keeping the lights on, those kinds of things. SRM is Sustainment, Restoration, and Modernization. That is what we would call minor military construction. It's paving roads, curbing. You can do some small procurement like HVAC units and so on. And then family programs is the last one on this slide.
I'm sorry. Which one of those would be acquisition of new weapon systems and all that?
That's not on this. This is just an installations portion of the budget. Sorry, sir. I wasn't clear on that. Yeah, this was just Army installations. Again, a slide here from this hammock that shows the cyclical nature of Army end strength. And as you know, the Army's made an announcement today, which we'll talk to a little bit later, as part of their force structure adjustment to reduce by 72,000 people their end strength by 2019. And that does have an Alaska impact, which I'll talk to. Ms. Hammock's slide, the Army and the Air Force want BRAC. They desperately need BRAC if you listen to the leadership. The problem that they've had is that they misfired in BRAC 2005. It was a transformational BRAC. It was not a cost savings BRAC. BRAC is not something that the Congress wants to do because they are worried about being beat up by their constituents and because BRAC was so poorly executed. I am not advocating BRAC, but I will also turn around and say we have last year's Air Force force structure adjustment hit us in Eielson. We have the Army force structure adjustment has some impacts in Alaska today. Fortunately, not so big, but in other places, 72,000 people are going to go away. The Air Force has already indicated that if a BRAC is not authorized for 2015, there will be another Air Force force structure adjustment released next February as part of their FY15 budget process. So the question becomes, do we want to operate with the risks and benefits in a process that is open, transparent, and has an independent review, or do we want to leave it to unelected officials in the Department of Defense to decide of their own volition where they're going to make cuts, where they're going to starve installations budgetarily, where they're going to reduce personnel or take missions away, and then announce that, and we have no real course of alternative other than for Congress to block the entire force structure adjustment, which is highly unlikely because they're not going to pick and choose where. I'm not going to make a recommendation because it's not my place to do so, but there are two sides to this coin when it comes to the BRAC process. If I could, again, you don't need me to read this to you, but this is, the last slide that's associated with my preliminary packet here on the need for a BRAC, and this is just the Air Force articulating why it's important to them. That would conclude these slides, and we'll move on to the ones that everybody has. And I hope this was helpful. Apologize that you didn't have them in advance.
And again, for Representative Feige, you know, those online, we will make those slides available by email as soon as we can. General Lesenko.
Steve, has the Army Air and the Air Force enjoyed any savings from joint basing?
The Air Force... Joint basing is still an experiment in process, I would say, and I can't say on a qualified basis at all of the joint bases, but the anecdotal information I have from talking to Mr. Brian Lepore at the GAO, who looks at this as an issue in my discussions with DOD, is they are yet to see any significant savings as a result of joint basing. In some cases, you've actually seen some increased costs. Having said that, they think that they're going to eventually get there, just like eventually there will be significant savings that came out of BRAC 05, but they aren't there yet. So it's a long way of saying I think the jury's still out, but if you ask me today, has there been significant savings, I think the answer is not yet. Hope that helps.
Mr. Chairman, McHugh Pierre for the record. General Lesnikoff, to add to that, locally what we've been told is that that is not the case at JBEAR. They have not seen savings. They've seen an increase in cost, and it's because both individual installations, Fort Richardson and Elmendorf Air Force Base, were operating at a much lower than required level of base operating costs. So when you look at the military and their structure, if they identify it as a requirement, as you know, then it must be funded. Well, as they went through the joint basing process, they identified requirements, which then boosted the overall budget of the joint base. So that was counterproductive for the short term, but I believe through some of the sequestration activities, they've certainly reduced the costs back down to where they were before.
Other questions? Good time for it.
Chairman, then what I'll do now is I'll move to the packet that we actually have.
Sorry, sir. Steve Hijack here. I'll move to the packet that everybody has, which is the strategic plan that we developed in conjunction with the AMFAST group. The AMFAST group has reviewed and approved the items that I'm going to describe to you here today that you have copies of.
And there's copies in the back for members of the audience, too.
Okay. Again, because I don't want to simply read slides to you because you're all very, very capable of reading slides, I'm going to just pick high points to highlight for each slide. I think the points that I want to make here, we've already talked through the Budget Control Act reductions and the impact that that is having, constraining in particular personnel costs, modernization costs, and operations and maintenance. Force structure adjustments. Last year, the Air Force released their force structure adjustment proposal, which was met with significant resistance by the U.S. Congress. And as a result, there was a deal that was cut at the end of the year between the Congress and the Air Force that allowed them to move forward with some actions and not with others. As we know, the delegation and others have accused the Air Force of using last year's force structure adjustment as a so-called backdoor BRAC. I think they've learned their lesson, and certainly the Army learned their lesson, because when the Army did their force structure adjustment, what the Army did was they laid out a case. You may not like the numbers, but what they started off with was a force, mixed force, designed to look at what the Army force looks like versus what it should look like. Then, having done that, they did data calls for each of the installations to see what their data would look like against how the force should look. With that then in mind, they went through the environmental process that was announced earlier this year called the PEA, or Programmatic Environmental Assessment, for 2020 Army force structure. And they identified 21 installations and provided potential actions where you could lose up to 8,000 people or gain up to 3,000, and went through all the environmental criteria to include economic impact. When they did that, they brought the public in for comment and also brought in public officials, which is something the Air Force didn't do until after they announced theirs. They issued a finding of no significant impact, indicating that they could go forward with execution of their plan, but they also did take the time to go to each of the 21 installations and conduct what they called listening sessions, and I know we had folks here participate in those. There are still going to be some people, no matter what happens, that are not happy with the Army's decisions, but to the Army's credit, in this case, they learned from the Air Force mistake, and they had a process, public input, and an end game. I think the Air Force, by the way, has learned from that, and they are going to be doing the same process for preparations for next year. With regards to the state of Alaska, and I heard some folks talking about this earlier, we have some information that we secured earlier in the day. It was, I would say, not a mixed bag of news, but I think very positive news overall for the state of Alaska. When we got done, Fort Wainwright will gain approximately 552 people. The 4th to the 25th is going to gain an enhanced engineer and mission command elements. At Fort Richardson will lose approximately 894 military personnel spaces. So when we get done, the state of Alaska nets out at minus 345. The average state loss that had military installation involved in the PEA was 1,500. So while we don't want to lose anybody, I think what this does is validates the points that we have continued to try to make about the tremendous training environment, the infrastructure that is here, and the strategic location that we have. So we've held our own. We've done pretty darn good. Now we have to be prepared for what comes next, and those are some of the things that we'll talk to with regards to the presentation.
Those decisions are done deals. There's no appeal or adjustment from those.
There, to the best of my knowledge, the answer will be no. Let me put it this way. Absent legislation from the U.S. Congress, no. Those are final decisions that were announced by the Army today to leadership. They will do a public affairs release tomorrow, which will include specific details to the public, and I'm sure they will also be providing robusted information to the delegation. You have the information that I've been able to secure in Alaska from D.C. this morning.
I want to thank members of this committee and others around the state who took part in the comments on it to help defend Alaska's position. This is, you're right, a good example of how we pull together. It does work. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So I just want to point out to members of the committee that I have passed out two handouts that are up from the Fairbanks area, thanks to both the Tiger Team and Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. One of these, Steve, you were just talking about the process and the Air Force learning about, well, from the Army about doing process. And yet we know that the Air Force already has their strategic basing process, and that doesn't seem to have been followed at all, and they convoluted it, and so this document that they have seems to, well, I'll be polite. It's just a pile of crap. It's contradictory to known facts and so forth. So is that going to help us? I know you might be addressing this a little bit later, but that seemed to be something that they don't even talk about, is their own basing process. And is that a leg that we have to stand on in this battle?
Mr. Chairman, McHugh Pierre, Representative Isaacson, are you referring to the SATAF report that was done?
He's talking about the strategic basing plan. I know exactly what he's talking about.
Sir, if I could, and again, this is Steve Hijack. The strategic basing plan, I'm not going to defend the Air Force, but just to make the point here, the strategic basing plan is a process that's used for new missions versus force structure adjustments. Force structure adjustments are the ability to move manpower and personnel or to reduce manpower or equipment that is not subject to either 10 U.S.C. 2687, which is the BRAC law, or 10 U.S.C. 993, which constrains them on the realignment of installations. So the strategic basing process, which, by the way, has its own issues, is primarily designed for purposes of, I'm going to do F-35 basing. How do I decide who makes the list to be evaluated, what the criteria are? I evaluate those bases. I come up with a short list of bases. I go do follow-on visits and collect more data, and I come up with the preferred alternative. So that's what the strategic basing process works, how it works, and what it's used for. And it is a process and a tool. I can tell you from personal experience that the process has at times recommended course A, and the Air Force has gone course B, because the trump card in all of these actions is military judgment. If military judgment supersedes what the strategic basing analysis results find, that will be the deciding factor by the Air Force leadership. The Air Force takes this and touts this as a defeatable, transparent, and repeatable process. Defendable, transparent, repeatable process. And again, they're looking at it primarily as, if I've got new things to hand out, how do I hand them out so that I'm not subject to criticism by the Air Force that I just picked my friends and gave them that mission? I hope that answers your question.
Partly. So what you're saying then, the executive summary of that, great explanation, was that we're misinterpreting the strategic basing process application to the F-16 move, even though they are looking for a home, as it were, for F-16.
Correct, because it is a mission that is already there, and so therefore it is an internal force structure operational cost analysis that's being done. Now, separately, as you know, PACAF, Pacific Air Forces, General Carlisle is doing his own strategic assessment of within his command of Eielson and how Eielson fits into the Air Force for the future. That is a command review, not part of the strategic basing process. But you are correct. The process is separate from what we had at Eielson last year.
In my testimony to the SATAF team when they were up, or the info-seeking group, was basically the SATAF came at the wrong time.
The SATAF is a group of Air Force officers that are there to find out how to execute a basic plan that has been provided to them. So in the case of your testimony before the SATAF, the Air Force made an internal analysis that resulted in the force structure process announced in March of 2012 for FY13, which included the Eielson 18th Aggressor Squadron move. As a result of the announcement, then what happens is the Air Force has to have an I plan, an implementation plan, to execute that movement that was part of the force structure process. To develop the I plan, you send what's called a SATAF, a Site Activation Task Force,
And again, their job is to, I've already got an answer, now I'm here to figure out how to execute the answer. And so that's what their defined mission is. They went out of the norm for purposes of the 18th aggressor SATAP because of the concerns expressed by the community, the state, and the delegation, and normally they wouldn't take public testimony for a SATAP. It's an internal review. This was an exception to the rule because of the contentiousness of this particular action. And as I said, not to beat it to death, that's separate from the strategic basing process, which is also, by the way, an internal Air Force process done at headquarters Air Force with input from the bases and the various major commands.
One last thing before, and then let you go on if I may. So in the EIS process, it looks like it's a regurgitation of SATAP or expanded elements of it. And I thought the EIS is supposed to be basically a pure document starting from scratch and finding all the truth. Doesn't that compromise the validity of the EIS if it's just basically the SATAP all over again?
Again, if I could, not to defend the Air Force. The EIS starts with a basic premise. I have a preferred alternative. This is what I propose to do. The difference between that and a SATAP is, in the SATAP, this is what I'm doing. Give me the plans. Tell me what I need to do to get from point A to point B. In the case of the EIS, I've identified where I think I should be at point B, but I go out for public input and public comment. That includes agencies, public interest groups, Joe and Jane citizens, everybody. And if they identify one of two things, significant new input or data that impacts my preferred alternative course of action, or the absence of data that should have impacted the preferred alternative, that can result in a record of decision which deviates from the preferred alternative. So it is a public process where new input is taken. If the new input is substantial and shows that there's been a clear deviation from fact leading to the preferred alternative, the Air Force would be compelled to modify the preferred alternative in their final EIS, which then goes out again for public comment before the issuance of a record decision. I know it's a long answer to a short question.
Just one last follow-up then.
Last one.
My final follow-up. the frustration is that, well, and I guess this might be good, the SATAP, as you mentioned, doesn't need public input. And yet we gave them books full, and you helped us. And it doesn't seem like any of that's reflected in here. In fact, it's just forgotten and abandoned. And I guess the good thing is that in the final EIS, all public communication has to be included, correct? So maybe that's good, but I guess I just want to make that frustrating point as you go on and help us sort through some of that.
What I would offer you for cause for optimism or at least perspective on this is not every record of decision reflects the preferred alternative. If I can give you a specific example, the Air Force proposed to put well over 150 F-35 Joint Strike Fighters at Eglin Air Force Base. And having gone through the EIS process, they had significant pushback by the city of Valparaiso in Florida, to the point that when they issued the final EIS, they cut in half the number of aircraft that were going to be stationed at Eglin Air Force Base because of the significant change in dynamics on environment, noise, property values, so on and so forth, and then required a supplemental EIS for the remaining roughly 55 aircraft. And in that supplemental EIS, the record of decision was not to put those planes there. So the point I want to make here is that it is not a fait accompli, but clearly it's trending in a direction, and it requires those who have concerns to really put together solid, fact-based, you know, data-substantiated arguments that say your EIS is flawed because you either said X and it's really Y, or you totally ignored this other factor, we'll call it Z, and had you included that, it would have changed your proposed action in the preferred alternative. Does that answer?
Yes, that's good for now. Thank you.
Sir. I don't seem to give short answers to any questions, sir. I apologize.
You're a man after my own heart.
Okay. This is just a map that shows major installations in the state of Alaska. And as we go forward, this is, you know, we have to remember the lessons of history and how we got to where we are. Oops, this is actually a different slide. Bear with me one second. All right. Okay, we're fine. We're just going to go with this. This just provides us the history of the past in terms of what happened in BRAC 2005, which sets the stage for our ability to conduct a strategic plan that that we did. What we tried to do is make sure that we looked at all the BRAC 05 analysis. By the way, I did work for the state in the 1995 BRAC. I did not represent the state during 2005.
Let me try. Apparently, this slide is not in the packs we got, so we'll ask for copies of that after the meeting.
It's not in the slide package that I have, sir. So we're both operating from the same premise.
You're not relieved by that, but
we're all good, though, sir. So this is what happened in 2005. That's one of the foundations for us to prepare the strategic plan. Then the other thing that we took into account was what would happen with regards to force structure adjustments. And again, yeah, these. I'll tell you what. If I may, rather than use the electronic one. If I looked at page,
it's just the alternate. It's alternated around.
Get your backup button.
Sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I want to see if their four
okay, yeah.
Looks like my. Does your slide four say strategic plan development?
Yeah.
By chance. It does.
Yes.
I'm going to pretend that this laptop doesn't exist, and I'm going to work off the same slide that we both have.
Okay.
And I apologize for.
If you can find them, throw them up in the slide as they come. If not, we'll just.
Yeah. We're good.
So the headlines.
We're to make sure we're all on the same sheet of music to include those who are on the phone. We're on slide number four, entitled Strategic Plan Development. Is that correct? We have the same package.
Right.
Beautiful. With that said, what this slide tries to provide you is a roadmap that we use to do our analysis and to develop the strategic plan that I'm going to walk through today. I do want to stress a strategic plan is a roadmap. It is not a fixed course. There will be deviations along the way as developments occur, but at least it gives us some parameters to decide, are we on the track? Do we want to go on this track? And are we on the right track in executing what we thought we should be doing? I also think that it's important that you recognize that this includes a coordinated, proactive plan of attack. This is not just the delegation, not just the state government, the governor's office, not just the legislature. It's all of us together to include the communities, which, again, kudos to the Tiger team and the group up there in the Fairbanks area. They have been very proactive. And if there's one thing I know from working with DOD, the more proactive you are, the more knowledgeable, and the more diligent, and the more you stay as a thorn in their side, the better off you have in the end winning, because the easy answer is for DOD or someone to say no when you go away. It's harder for them when you stay in their face. Our objective in the strategic plan was not just to hold our own, but to protect what we've got and look for opportunities to expand. As we've touched on before, we are looking for opportunities for partnership with DOD on shared services. And in fact, we discussed that, Mr. Pierre and I discussed that with the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Air Force, Tim Bridges, about 2 weeks ago, and I will touch on that a little bit later on in my slides. I want to make the point for anybody who says, gee, why are we doing this? What about others? I can assure you, and I'd be happy to provide a list, that there are over 30 states that either have a state consultant, a series of consultants representing their installations, or some form of a governor's-led military council. So everybody knows that there are challenges out there, and if they are interested in protecting their installations, they've started the process of organizing themselves to be ready for the future. Next slide, which again, to be sure we're together, should say strategic plan headlines, and this first bullet should be overall.
I'm sorry, at the bottom of my slide it says it's critical that this analysis remain confidential. Is that still operative? Or?
Yes, I mean, what I would say is the version that I will discuss today has been somewhat sanitized, so I don't have all of the details that we would not want competitors to have. There is one that is a more detailed, deliberative document that is available for review, but it is not something that I think that we want to review in a committee hearing, because it does have some of the challenges and some of the strengths that we have we want to use as our assets. Thank you, sir. Thank you for reminding me of that bullet. So slide five, strategic planning headline. I think what this tries to do is give you overall some of the big state issues that we want to make sure that we are stressing. And the next slide, which I'll come to in just a moment, we'll talk about some of the service-specific headlines. What do we want to really stress from a state standpoint? And you guys all know this. Our strategic location, our unencumbered training space. This is a military-friendly state. We are playing a key role, and in fact, we have our missile defense role growing as a result of our good friends in North Korea. We are committed to the military, and we do the things that we need to do, both in terms of goodwill, and you have stepped up the plate on many occasions in terms of laying money against that goodwill to support our bases. And I think it's important that we remember to do that and continue to do so. And as part of what we'll talk about later on this briefing, we also need to be prepared to take that message out to not just Alaska, take that out to the major commands that oversee the installations here, as well as to the Department of Defense at the Pentagon, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Slide six, if I could, folks, will take us to Army and Air Force headlines. I think the most important thing on the Army slide would be we have the room to expand training from units from the lower 48. We don't have a lot of them come up here. But the way we make that work is we have to make it easy for them. You know, the proverbial, if you build it, they will come. One of the things we are trying to take a look at is the ability to pre-position equipment. Just like the National Training Center in Fort Irwin, where they have a unit that's already there that's an opposing force. They have equipment that can be drawn upon. Units can bring their own equipment. If we can put equipment pre-positioned here in the state of Alaska for units from the lower 48 to come up and train here and find out what it's really like to train in an Arctic condition, then they're more likely to do so versus if they have to haul it themselves, because that is a huge, huge cost for them.
Representative Isaacson, question?
Yes. How?
Well, we're drawing down the forces by 72,000 people. There is therefore still equipment that those 72,000 people were using. Some of it we know is going to flow down to the Army National Guard, which is a plus and a minus for the Guard. Good news is short-term modernization. Bad news is later on when they want to modernize, they're going to say, gee, we just gave you a bunch of really good equipment. But we want to get ourselves in the mix if we can for that. We also are aware, based on conversations that I've had with the delegation and with the Army, that even U.S. Army Pacific and PACOM is looking at the idea of pre-positioned stores. That would be either in Hawaii or in Alaska. They have not made a decision in terms of which location, nor they have decided the configuration of what that equipment might look like. So as part of this strategic plan, we want to help them define what the package would look like. We need to help them identify where those assets could be secured from. And on our own and in conjunction with our delegation, we want to try to convince the Army leadership, you just showed your trust and confidence in the state of Alaska by barely nicking us in this force structure adjustment. For those who say we don't fight in Arctic conditions, let's go take a look at Afghanistan. Mountainous, cold weather conditions. Are we training for that? If not, we need to be thinking about how we do so. And the best way for that to happen is for you, the Department of the Army, to provide us the tools to help others to come, because we know the long pole in the tent, as it always is cost.
So, Mr. Chair, follow up.
Isaacson.
Pragmatic step. Legislature needs to appropriate funds to build storage structures, or what are you saying?
I would say if you say legislature as in state or federal.
State.
I think
if we're appropriating federal assets,
yes, sir,
for pre-storage or pre-position, we're going to have to keep them someplace.
My comment first, and then.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Pierre would like to make a comment, but if I could just briefly answer. I certainly think that that is a measure of good faith and something that the state should seriously consider, but then we get into the risk management. Do you want to build the shelter until you know that we're going to have the mission and the ability to get the equipment, or do you want to step up to the plate and say, we're willing to do so, so this will be a cost that we will take off the table if the Army decides to go forward? And so the short answer is I think it's something to consider. The question becomes the proverbial cart and horse, which comes first.
If I could just grab onto that, and maybe McHugh will answer that too, but we know various states, Louisiana and so forth, they're already building stuff in hope for the mission. If too many of those states are already building stuff and we don't, are we behind the power ball?
And Mr. Chairman, McHugh Pierre, Representative Isaacson, that's exactly the point that I think we're trying to make with this committee hearing, is that other states are doing it, and we need to find out, with your help, how we can best do it too, so we compete and we're not left behind. And the one thing we offer that's better than anybody else is training. Everybody at the Defense Communities Association, all the Pentagon members that were there, all the assistant secretaries and undersecretaries, all said the training space needs to get bigger because the weapon systems are getting longer. And who has bigger space? Nobody but us. Navy, Air, Army, we've got it all. And so what do we do for investment? You're right on. I would say that you're a step ahead, because right now in Jay Park, we don't have the roads off of the bridge to get through that marshy area first. So if we do some rudimentary gravel roads, then we can address where do we put storage centers, because that's the perfect place. So we put some storage centers off some gravel roads, basically some warehouses, until then, maybe we utilize existing warehouses in the Fairbanks area or in South Central. But you're right on, and that's where we need to come together as a group and identify how much are we willing to spend, where are we willing to spend it, and what's the best bang for the buck.
Well, and if I might add to that list.
One more, and then get to the presentation.
And the key might also be how much do we need to, how much pre-positioned equipment are you asking us to draw?
I would say we want to have at least a battalion size, and to me that would be the proper size. Company's not sufficient enough. It'd be nice if it was a brigade size. I think that's too big. I don't think that's achievable. So short answer, battalion size would be the target. And I'm very conscious of not offering to spend the state's money, which is why I was hesitant about answering your question. But I think it's certainly in the end, the more you, going back to what I said earlier, the more we step up to the plate and offer something, the harder it is for them to say no. I just don't want to put the taxpayers' dollars at risk of building a building and then not, they don't come. That's why I hesitated.
I know there's a number of such suggestions deeper in the report, so I'm going to ask you to continue with the report.
Yes, sir, and I'm conscious of the fact that we've already gone for an hour, and I'm still only partway through, so I'm going to move quickly. Last point on slide 6, F-35, there is some hope that we will see some positive movement very soon with regards to F-35 actions that could impact the state of Alaska, and we think we are extremely well positioned for purposes of what they call OCONUS, outside the continental United States basing. And I would only urge you to wait out. I think you'll see some action on that very, very soon, and we have been working that diligently. Moving on to slide 7, the Coast Guard, very important here to the state of Alaska. We have the benefit of having member Rear Admiral Underwood on the MFAS team. He's been very active in terms of working with the MFAS team and the state. On what we need to do to support the Coast Guard, both in terms of modernization, like combat rescue helicopter, and getting them involved. Mr. McHugh, I think, has some plans with regards to leadership of DHS and Coast Guard coming to visit the state. So we're very conscious of making sure that we are working with Coast Guard leadership. Do you have anything you want to add?
Mr. Chairman, you know, the Coast Guard is making some developments, and through your support, the legislature as a whole, helping ADA be able to lend to federal installations or federal entities. We are building that building on Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson for Anchorage Sector to be co-located with us. So we'll have the search and rescue response nexus that no other state has, and it is viewed at the secretary level as the example of partnership across the country. Secretary Napolitano is coming up to take a tour of that very soon. I'll be with her and also promoting one other piece, and that's the Spartan, C-27J aircraft. It's a smaller aircraft that's basically half the size of a C-130 for layman's terms, and the Air Force is not going to receive it, and the Coast Guard is going to get some of that. So what we're advocating is that you add a squadron of Spartans up here, put them on J-Bear or in Eielson if possible, and utilize existing infrastructure that would allow the Coast Guard to patrol the Arctic while keeping the C-130s down in Kodiak to police the biomass. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the latest development there, and we look forward to the growth industry being the Coast Guard. They're not under the same budget cuts, thankfully.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we move to slide 8, we finally get to the meat and potatoes, which is the priority actions that have identified for purposes of the strategic plan that was reviewed by the MFAST. Let me start off with number 1. This is a self-evident issue, I'm sure, but let me just make sure I identify the elephant in the room. Energy costs are a real problem for us with the Department of Defense. They are a real problem for the Department of Defense, period. The Air Force could care less about green energy unless it's going to be green and it's going to reduce the cost of fuels. And I don't mean that to be pejorative. They're looking at cutting costs. The more that we're able to help reduce energy costs here in the state, for our DOD installations, the more effective we become in terms of retaining them. I also am very conscious, not being an Alaskan, but having been around here enough, that whatever we do on energy has to benefit everybody in the state of Alaska, not just the installations. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact, if you said, what's your one takeaway, Steve Hijack, and how we help our bases in Alaska, it's energy. We've got to reduce those costs. I'd like to ask Mr. Pierre if he would talk briefly about a conversation that we just had with Mr. Bridges, specifically on the issue of energy and specifically on the potential for use of natural gas for power generation versus coal.
Mr. Chairman, thank you again for the record. What we talked about was the issue at Eielson. we all know, and hopefully we can bring you guys up there to take a tour of the power plant. And I talked to the chairman briefly about this. The power plant up there is antiquated. The boilers are old, 1950s era, and they're being replaced slowly, but not quickly enough to benefit us, benefit the community, benefit the air quality. So one thing that could be done to help lower the cost and improve the air quality in the Fairbanks area is to replace those boilers. There's four left that need to be replaced. They can only be replaced with three boilers. We could buy those boilers. We could wheel power down to Fort Wainwright, and then the air is not being as polluted in the Fort Wainwright area because you're developing power in the wintertime, burning coal out at Eielson. And those boilers can also be upgradable to natural gas burning. That way we have the ability to lower cost for everybody, hopefully. That's the goal. And then we can also improve the air quality for everybody during the winter. So that's something that we need to have a more thorough discussion about as far as the impact, the, you know, how much is enough? Is it too much? Is it not enough? And is it going to really make a big difference when you look at the overall base operating cost reduction for the interior?
I would also just add one small point, then I'll move on to, in the interest of time. If you think that this is not just an issue in Alaska, as I think many of you know, I represent some other states on military installations, and in 2005 in the state of New York, state of New York's legislature implemented something called Patriot Power. What Patriot Power did was to provide economic development rates to each of the military installations for their electricity as well as their natural gas, which reduced their base operation support costs. So instead of paying the market value, what they would normally pay based on their utilization, they got an additional 10 to 15% discount on their natural gas and their electrical rates. And in one case, it actually reduced the cost, the base operation support cost, by over 18% at that installation. So there are creative ways out there to do these things besides.
Just to clarify, so Patriot Power, basically the state of New York, would subsidize energy costs for their bases by 10 or 15% of their cost?
By providing them an economic development rate that they would offer to a corporation of the same size coming into the state.
And Senator Faircloth has a question.
Any clarity? Are you telling us that the military base would be allowed to upgrade to a new coal fire plant without new pit permitting, but we are going to be stuck with the university?
Well, through the chair, Senator Faircloth, that's a very good question. They have already been permitted for new coal boilers at their power plant. They have two, one's being installed this year and one's being installed next year. So I don't know how that intersects with the university's efforts or issues that they have with EPA and with DEC. I do know that the getting new boilers at Eielson's power plant will increase their operating costs by $10 million because new coal boilers have new EPA filtration restrictions, which are increase with the filtration costs. Now, certainly we can decrease the power costs overall by buying cheaper coal by utilizing a shared services agreement, but we're looking at some additional challenges with using coal. That's why it's so important that we get natural gas to the area, not just for our use, but for the military's use as well.
Mr. Pierre, can you tell me, then, you made a statement about going from 4 to 3. Is that to try to hold down the cost or keep it equal, or is there less power generation needed, or are there more efficient generation available?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Faircloth, you nailed it. It's more efficient, more power with less physical plant. So it's just the old boilers. These are literally, 1950s boilers. They look really cool when you go and check them out, something that should be in a museum, and they're breaking down all the time. So they can generate the same amount of power with one less boiler today because of the improved technology.
No question.
Then on the same note, so the military is advancing forward on replacing the coal fire, and so you're proposing that the state, if we wanted to incentivize higher air quality for our communities, might want to invest in gas, and you believe that then Department of Defense would accept that? And so I have two questions there. Is gas generation more expensive? Apparently so.
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, you nailed that again. So the Obama administration does not want to burn coal, period. So DOD does not want to burn coal at all, even though it's significantly cheaper than natural gas. But because of the, when new boilers are put online, so there's six boilers right now at the Allison Power Plant. One is being replaced this summer, one will be replaced next summer. Those have been purchased already. As soon as those are able to be converted to natural gas, it would actually save the power plant money because they're going to have increased filtration costs due to the efforts to not burn any more coal. So even though it's more expensive per BTU, it's cheaper overall to operate. And I think that in the long term, as a state investment, and I was very clear, and I know others have been to the Pentagon, there's no way we as a state can invest in physical infrastructure if there's not an active duty mission at the base. That's just ludicrous. Now, I can tell you this, it's a wise investment, potentially a wise investment, because we get to keep infrastructure through a BRAC. So if we can lower costs for residents in the short term, we can improve air quality, and we get to keep all the improvements that we've made. If it is BRAC, that seems like a good situation across the board. But obviously, this is a broad brush idea. We have not dug into the details of this, and we'll have to have further discussions to see what the overall costs are.
Senator Farquhar, Senator Coghill, question?
You got the question.
Yes, I'm great. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wondering if you could get an update on what we just did at J-Bear in regards to power generation and consolidation. Is that an example of a shared services agreement? Because I'm forgetting the details.
Yeah, certainly. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that is not a shared services agreement in the fact that we're in the manner we're talking about. But it is a similar type of agreement where the municipality is using the land for the landfill, and then the base has taken a green energy initiative to harvest the natural gas that's developed by the landfill, and that's produced tremendous results. They've lowered their costs already, and they're producing more power this first year than they thought they would by far. I don't have the exact numbers, but they're doing very, very well. And that's the kind of stuff that the military overall is trying to do. And I neglected, Mr. Chairman, to say that when we met with Undersecretary Bridges, he used to be an environmental program director down here for Pacific Air Forces in Honolulu, and is very much concerned and involved in the Alaska power situation. He's been through our facilities. He wants to see things improved, and he was excited about the possibility that he could see the Eielson power plant be modernized, because he said that's a failure under his watch. He wanted to get that done, and his eyes lit up, and he said, man, I'd love to work with you guys however possible to get that done. So we know that the number one cost, you know, that's driving consideration of removing force structure and bases in Alaska is the energy. So if we can figure out a way to hit that sweet spot and lower cost for everybody and improve what we have, I think that's our lowest hanging fruit.
Yeah, please proceed.
I'd also make the point, if I could, for Senator Faircloth, that Mr. Bridges is not only the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Installations, he sits on the basing committee that would look at new missions for installations. And he also has a role with regards to the 18th Aggressor Squadron EIS. That doesn't mean that should be the reason why we do this, but the fact that he was very personally engaged on that, I think, is an attribute for consideration.
And follow-up, Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have, when we're talking about pre-positioning assets, we've talked about gravel roads, some storage space, and now we're talking about upgrading turbines. Do we have any breakdown on overall costs at a 30,000-foot level, or are these just ideas that are for our consideration right now?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, no, we don't have any idea of costs. These are just ideas, and the reality is that the cost might not be there for us as we continue to pursue it, but this is the first step in the plan to identify what ideas are actually possible that will make a difference. And then as we get together in the coming months, we'll have to identify how much each idea is going to cost and what that investment is going to return to our military strategic analysis and the future impact of bases or the decision to potentially close bases. So,
go ahead, Senator Pickwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we know if there's a power share agreement or the ability, if there's excess generation, if the state were to invest, that there's a share agreement for the Fairbanks area that would somehow lower their utility costs?
through the chair, Senator Faircloth, I know one of your members, Tim Jones, is working for Doyon, and he might be able to answer that more if he's on the phone. But I know that there is an agreement set aside where GVEA can currently buy excess power, and they can share and wield. So I know there is the basis of that set up. We might have to develop it further under some type of shared services plan like we had talked about earlier, but that is one of the pieces that we're looking at.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I was throwing that out is if we're going to subsidize, seems like the wrong word, if we're going to invest and we lower the cost of a kilowatt or whatever power is being generated, then the people of Alaska, at least in the community adjacent, would be able to receive that cost benefit versus an electrical utility for profit, even if it's a non-profit utility, shouldn't be able to buy it at a reduced cost and then pass on the savings in the form of their own retained earnings.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, that was our number one concern, Senator Faircloth, when we were talking about this idea with Steve in New York, is that, you know, New York State invests to bring other businesses there, and they are throwing around money like that. We, frankly, don't. So it would be not prudent for us to propose this idea to you guys if the community did not benefit either. That's just absolutely ridiculous. And I know that all of your constituents would not be happy to hear you propose something that doesn't benefit them as well, because that's not the Alaskan way. So we're very aware of that.
I do know that the General Hogue is working on an interjurisdictional task force with three major goals, including cooperation between civilian and local authorities, air quality issues, and wheeling power and so forth. So the same questions are being addressed at a number of different levels. I will ask if Tim Jones online, if you want to add any comments to this issue right now.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thank you very much. I appreciate the offer, and I do have a couple of comments. First, Senator, as far as I know, there's no agreement currently in place because it really hasn't been an issue to this point. The military had no opportunity, nor was it really in a position to be able to sell their excess power, provide their excess power to the civilian market. I'm sure that is something that could be worked out. The other point I'd like to make, though, and it goes to the cost of energy, is I too believe that energy is a major cost driver for the high cost of operations, but you can't look at it specific only to the military installations. Yes, if we can lower the cost of producing energy on the military installations, by all means, we need to do that. But I don't think you can take it out of the overall cost of energy in the community, because it really is energy is a cost driver. So the high cost of energy in the interior drives the higher construction cost, the higher materials cost, the higher cost of services, and so on. So I think we need to take a more global look at reducing the overall cost of energy, and if we can bring that down, we're also going to be able to impact the cost of base services.
Thank you, Colonel Jones. With that, I'm going to ask Mr. Hydrick to continue his presentation. Lots of good information deeper in our slides, so if you'll continue, please.
We'll move on to slide number 9, if I could, promote the awareness of Alaska strategic and operational value. Two key takeaways from this slide. Number one, I certainly recommend that we ought to have a high-level delegation from the state of Alaska go to PACAF, but also come to the Pentagon for purposes of meeting with senior Army and Air Force officials, as well as the Office of Secretary of Defense. With all respect, if I may, I just had, pardon me for talking about another state, I just had the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Kansas, along with the Governor's Military Council, which was a mix of state legislators, the Adjutant General, the member of the Air Force, the Chief Civic Leaders Group, and the civilian aide to the Secretary of the Army. And we met in the office of the Secretary of Defense's conference room, and we met with 3- and 4-star level individuals, and we addressed a wide array of issues. And it was not, we love our base. We came in with a series of items we wanted to discuss, objectives we wanted to secure, not all of which we did, but we at least then, as a result of the discussions, had action plans that emanated for that. It is extremely important to the Department of Defense that you show that you are a credible knowledge base, that you're proactive, and you're equally a credible deterrent, that if they decide to take negative action, you understand their issues as well as they understand them, and you're prepared to take action. both as a positive way as well as to block any negative action. So if I could encourage, I think it really needs to be that sort of cross of legislative, local officials, and others to go to Washington. I realize it's not a small cost. I understand the time. I just got the opportunity to fly up here and fly back tonight. But it is extremely important to be seen as being knowledgeable and proactive. The other thing that I would have suggested in the strategic plan is, which would cost money, so let me just say that, look at the idea of having a well-recognized organization like, and I'll just use as an example, if I may, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, to do a paper specifically on not just the philosophy, but the nuts and bolts of the strategic location of Alaska to project power quickly to Europe as well as quickly to the Pacific Rim, and then use that as a cost analysis to say, well, what if I had to do this from the lower 48? I may have some higher operational cost to be in Alaska, but if I have to do it from the lower 48, this is what it takes for me to be able to do so going east or west, let alone east and west. And, oh, by the way, CSIS is headed by Dr. John Hamry, who is the former Deputy Secretary of Defense and very well revered and respected within the Pentagon. I happen to know Dr. Hamry. I've known him since 1981. I'm not, you know, endorsing him as the group to go to, but I just give them as an example of somebody other than us who can really provide an empirical as well as an operational rationale as to why Alaska is so important.
And Sam Nunn's still the chairman, so that would carry weight, too. Would that be seen as counter-arguments? Has that had the same credibility with the Pentagon when it comes to the analysis of the costs?
No, I think it actually helps us out, because while it may not have some of the level of detail that DOD uses on their installation analyses, it will have, I know Dr. Hamry well, he will have very good metrics to be able to show that if I'm going to deploy a squadron of aircraft from Eielson or J-Bear, and I'm going to go to Korea, and I'm going to take that same squadron, and I'm going to go to Aviano, Italy, and then compare that to pick a location in the lower 48 or two locations, he will be able to come up with those kind of numbers. And I think that's we need to make sure that we show them the cost issues as well as the operational issues as well. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yep, I think so.
Terrific, sir. In the interest of time, we'll move on to the next slide, and that would be slide number 10, action item number 4, strengthen the relationship between the state of Alaska with USARAC and U.S. Coast Guard District 7. I can offer just two small points on this, one of which I've already covered. Admiral Underwood, very actively engaged, working with us as well as with the U.S. Coast Guard to make sure that we are looking out for and being proactive on the relationships as well as the needs of the Coast Guard. Luckily, because of the fact that I have been doing this work for a long time, I get to run across people. The new PACOM commander, who's just been promoted to four-star, General Brooks, comes from Fort Riley, Kansas, and is an individual I've had the opportunity to work with as a result of work I've done with the state of Kansas. So I believe that with General Brooks down there, we'll be able to help with regards to Alaska as well as PACOM, drawing together the relationships there and making sure we support the Army here in Alaska.
Vince Brooks?
Representative Feige.
Yeah, was that ahead, Vince Brooks?
Is there someone in line with a question?
The fellow who got promoted, was that Vince Brooks or his brother?
Yes, sir. Vince Brooks, yes, sir.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
And for the record, that was Representative Feige.
All right, sir. On action number 5, which is leverage opportunities on force structure adjustments, again, if I could make a point, and this is an opinion, so let me stress that. We're all working really hard to hold the 18th Aggressor Squadron at Eielson Air Force Base. If we hold the 18th, and as you know, we recommended and the governor did move forward with a letter that was submitted to the Air Force that suggested that the other single squadron wing in the U.S. Air Force is at Spangdahlem, and the rationale that was provided by the previous PACAF commander as to why we needed to look the 18th, moving him down to Jaber, was it was the only single squadron wing. If we are able to prevail in the record of decision on the 18th Aggressor Squadron, we're still a single squadron wing in the Air Force, and we stick out like a sore thumb. So we need to not just hold our own. We need to, as part of the strategy, be looking at how we make it a two-squadron wing so it is more in conformity with other units in the Air Force. I have not given up on other USAFE assets that we could take a look at for purposes of relocation and vehicles to do so. It is not going to happen within the construct of the EIS that's underway, because the Air Force has already made that clear. But going back to the point about not just being on the defense but being on the offense, we need to hold what we got on the 18th, but we've got to robust that with a second unit, because if we don't, when a BRAC comes around, you know, we're going to be a likely target again, because the first thing that departments do is they look at what they refer to as broken glass, and those are the things that they didn't get in the last BRAC, and that's the first thing they're going to focus on for the next one. So it's extremely important for us to do that on the 18th, and then we've already talked about earlier with Representative Isaacson the idea of providing additional equipment here for training at Fort Wainwright. Slide number 11. This is the infrastructure improvements to expand the search and rescue capability of the Coast Guard and Alaska. One of the proposals that we have is that there are six, I believe. I got to check my numbers, but I believe it's six combat search and rescue units that are in the reserve component of the Air Force. None of those units are going to get C-130Js. We're not in the buy plan. We're hoping at some point in time that all of us will get combat rescue helicopter, but that is a program that has been competed and recompeted three times thus far. Additionally, because of the fact that search and rescue, which is a very highly demanded capability, it has moved back and forth repeatedly between Special Operations Command and Air Combat Command, and as a result of that, you don't have the proverbial godfather who is looking out for you. When that happens, you have situations like we have in Alaska, New York, California, Arizona, Nevada, and Florida, where I'm not getting the modernization dollars on my fixed wing assets, I'm not getting the new assets on the rotary wing, we're putting these guys' lives on the line to go out and save people, we're not giving them very good equipment, and then we turn around, the major command instills upon them a personnel requirement that they unfund. So they give them on the order of 200 to 300 spaces that they have to fill, but no funds are provided to them by the major command. Each of the search and rescue units are facing similar problems, and each one has, in a stovepiped effort, tried to solve their problems. What we recommend for consideration is that, in conjunction with the Adjutant General and the Adjutant Generals of the other states and their delegations, not to create a caucus, because a caucus is a congressional body that sometimes is very effective and sometimes is just a great way to meet, but a coalition of those states to be able to then, as a group of members, go to the Department of Defense and the Air Force and say, you've got to fix these problems. You either need to fund these billets or you need to make the billets go away. You need to put these people that are putting their lives on the line on the roadmap for C-130J. You certainly need to make sure the rescue helicopter program occurs. Oh, by the way, those delegations include members on all of the four defense oversight committees, to include Chairman Buck McKeon from Arizona, and it also includes the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Reid. So that's a recommendation. It requires coordination. It's not going to happen overnight, but we think that that is an important mission for us to be able to look at going forward. In terms of quality of life initiatives, I would say certainly this is an important issue. Nobody questions the importance of taking care of quality of life for our military personnel. We do all also live in a very tight budget environment, so we need to be looking for opportunities to address these actions where we can, either in support from local communities and in industry, or in non-fiscally constrained initiatives.
Representative Tarr has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just an issue of importance to me with the ongoing discussion about the sexual assaults and the high numbers that are, you know, occurring. And just wondering, you know, if you have additional ideas. This is just a little bit vague. You know, we don't want to overstep boundaries in terms of jurisdiction, in terms of how people, although that conversation is happening, are prosecuted for those crimes. But do you have any examples or know of things that are happening in other locations that we might want to consider as, you know, specific ways we can engage in family support?
Sure. Not specifically on the sexual assault area, but certainly I am familiar with organizations in various installations which put together, and again, this to some degree goes back to intergovernment, the shared services, but they already have in place interagency working groups between the garrison commander's office and the personnel office at the installation, along with the health and social services offices of local government, on everything from daycare, health care, specialty medical care, particularly in the area of behavioral sciences. So those are being done. Also, as much as possible, installations, particularly on the Army side, that have the Wounded Warrior Transition Units, we marry them up with local organizations, both private sector as well as public sector, to not only help them with the transition, but real jobs, real job training, not just, you know, the come to a job fair and sign on your name and say you're a veteran. So there are some programs. I'd be happy if I could just admit for you for the record later on some specific examples.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, McHugh Pierre for the record. I'd just like to make a statement about sexual assault because it is top of mind. It's in the news everywhere. This is unacceptable in the workplace, no matter where you work. And we take it very seriously at DMVA. It's every allegation that is brought before us, we investigate. And if it's smells of any criminal activity, we turn it over to the local law enforcement immediately. We have a person in our department that specifically works on sexual assault cases, an investigator, a former APD member, and we will not tolerate that type of behavior in our workplace. And I think it's appropriate that every entity, whether you're government, corporate, nonprofit, take the same stance. I would like to say this about sexual assault in the military. The military has increased its definition of sexual assault and made what might not have been a crime before a crime today. And therefore, there is a lot more reporting of crimes that happen. And you also have to understand that the military active duty, not the guard, owns that person 24 hours a day. So where your coworker, one of the legislative staffer, might be out at the bar and might grope somebody, that's not something you're going to hear about in the news. But in the military, that's prosecuted as sexual assault. And so it's just something to keep in mind. It's inappropriate behavior, and I think as a culture, as Americans, we need to address it. And it's starting in the military, but it's something that we can take into our organizations and into each one of your offices. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate that, Mr. Pierre. Please proceed, Mr. Roger.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I think one of the other things I just briefly want to touch on is on the recruitment and retention issue. And I recognize that every state has different dynamics, and every unit and community has their unique challenges. I think the only point that I want to make here is that just as I mentioned, the search and rescue units who have unfunded billets, and therefore that affects their remaining numbers and their retention numbers, we also have to be cognizant of the fact that one of the top priorities for the Adjutant General and for the state is to get an active association in place for the 168th up at Eielson. For us to do that, we really have to do a good job of making sure that we're meeting our remaining numbers as much as possible, because if we go to Air Mobility Command, who decides whether an active association is going to occur, we have to, and that's at Scott Air Force Base in Illinois, we have to remember they have to donate aircraft and they have to donate people. And the first question they're going to say is, are we at 100% manning or not? And if we're not, why am I going to provide people when the guard unit itself is not fully manned?
For those listening, could you explain what an active association means, what it implies?
I could, just to be clear, there are two kinds of associations. An active association is that takes place at a reserve component installation, a guard or a reserve base, where they are the host and there are a number of active duty personnel who join them, housed in the community, and they cooperate the equipment of that unit. That is an active association. There are more of those that are coming into play, and in fact, if you may have noticed, the Air Force in particular has created an active association in Burlington, Vermont, which is the first guard unit that will get the F-35 if they can get through some environmental issues. And they also have created an active association at Pease Air Force Base for their new KC-46 tanker. So they know this is a vehicle by which they can get these new platforms into the guard, but do so with active duty personnel around. More often than not, you'll see what's called a classic association, and we have that here at J-Bear, where the 176 is housed at an active duty installation, and they share aircraft and they perform missions together. So that's a classic association. The benefit of getting us an active association at the 168 would be more personnel, more equipment, more ability to support both operational as well as training mission requirements, positions us for a future round of KC-46 basing that's going to specifically be focused on the Guard. And that's why that's important. Okay. If I could, moving on, and I'm going to just touch on slide 12 because I think I have probably beaten this issue to death for all of you, and that's slide 12 is really all about shared services and the ICE map. Key points there, as you all know, is we need to look at identifying and having the communities actively engaged. And again, kudos to Mayor Hopkins in the back here. looking at places where we can identify specific missions and functions, putting together the organizational structure where we can show the military department and the community both will benefit, either in terms of efficiencies, better performance of service and provision of services, or cost savings. And in the end, right now, DOD is heavily focused on those cost savings. Again, some states are, just like the Air Force and the Army, some states are already moving out very, very smartly on it. The Army is moving out slowly. We're just in the embryonic stages, but I think what we have done is we've started, particularly in the Fairbanks area, particularly on the Eielson side of things, I think we've shown good credibility right off the bat. And again, going back to the meeting with Mr. Bridges, I think there's a welcomeness from the department to do so. ICEMAP, the only point I want to make on ICEMAP is, and I will provide you, if you would like, sir, for the record, a briefing from the Air Force on ICEMAP. It only applies to the Air Force, but it is a glimpse into the future of where the Army is going to go and things that we need to be thinking about and worrying about for the future.
How fast could you turn that around and make that happen? Because we do envision another meeting in a couple weeks here.
Sir, since I go back on Thursday, I would envision having that to you by Friday.
We will talk.
Very good, sir. Moving on to slide 13. These are now beyond the initial seven or eight recommendations that we had. These are some infrastructure recommendations. I'm going to breeze through them very quickly because they were not necessarily part of the formal agenda approved by ANFAS, but they knew that these were things that some tactical kind of issues that we should address. Enhanced use lease. If I could go back to where you save money for DOD, base operation support costs, construction costs, enhanced use lease is a way to help them avoid construction costs. Housing, whether it's housing privatization or it's management of rent controls and renter insurance that impacts basic allowance for housing. The other area which comes into your realm as well as into other agencies' realms are collaboration and cooperation on regulatory issues. DOD appreciates it when they have the opportunity to be engaged and to provide comment. They also loathe finding out that in some cases regulations may be put in place at a location and it impacts the installation and there was no collaboration or cooperation. So their message is we understand that regulatory actions need to be taken. We just encourage that we be included in the dialogue and having provided input, we'll have to respect the decisions of the agencies. We just had one of those in another state where we were able to turn things around because of that kind of collaboration, avoided an encroachment issue. The military operations urban terrain range at J-Bear, I wanted to highlight that to say I don't know that the impact of today's force structure adjustment will affect this, but I did want to make note that this was done before we knew about the personnel impacts at Fort Richardson. If we move on to slide number 14, I would say that some of these things have been overtaken by event because these were items that we identified during our visit to Eielson last year. But I think the basic message is we need to keep the infrastructure in place. We don't need the Air Force taking any of that infrastructure away or letting it go away by not properly maintaining it and letting the environment put it into a condition of disrepair. And we need to make sure that we keep all the assets that we can there for either a future mission or, God forbid, in the future, if we needed it for reuse, we have it for reuse. We don't want to think about reuse, but we just want to make sure that the Air Force does not allow the proverbial termites to undercut the infrastructure at the installation. Moving forward to slide 15, now that we've covered infrastructure, let's talk about new missions. I think this is a relatively well-known item. This is something we've been talking about for a year now, and we're happy to see it's come to fruition. The Army has confirmed its intent to identify an installation in the 25th Infantry Division for the Gray Eagle remotely piloted aircraft, or I'm sorry, the Army calls them unmanned aerial systems. Neither the two services can't even agree on what to call them, for crying out loud. Anyway, we know that they are looking at them going in during the FY15 timeframe, and they are deciding between Hawaii and Alaska. They are taking a look at the potential to base Gray Eagles for Fort Wainwright, either from Fort Greeley or from Eielson Air Force Base. And the Secretary of the Air Force just approved a site survey by the Army to go and visit Eielson for purposes of that evaluation. Our message is we want it in Alaska, not in Hawaii, with all due respect to our friends down south. On the AirCav unit with regards to Fort Wainwright, I think right now we have to, again, stand by, having just had a major force structure adjustment. Elements of that are down at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. I think that's still something we want to look at for the future, but at this stage in time, I think it's premature for us to take action, so that one I would likely recommend that we set aside for the moment.
Before you go on.
Question briefly, Representative Isaacson.
Very, very brief, and it's more of a comment, Mr. Chair, and it's just to highlight slide 14. You moved real quickly, and I hesitated whether or not to share this, but the basis, and correct me if I'm wrong, the basis for being able to move the F-16s from Eielson to J-Bear is because the F-15 facilities were not demolished on J-Bear. However, part of the proposal is the possible demolition of all the F-16 affected hangars and such, and that's a huge stretch, which off of Eielson, which then would remove any possibility of inexpensively moving other missions to Eielson that might share that equipment. So I wanted to highlight that, Mr. Chairman. The only way that this is tenable to move F-16s to J-Bear is they did not demolish good facilities and so are looking at remodeling those. And I think we need to highlight that.
Senator Fricklaw, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering, in a more global aspect, if a recommendation from Alaska might be that the military review all demolitions and make sure they're for life safety reasons right now instead of destroying assets that might be later used, because some of the assets that they're using now is to destroy existing infrastructure for various reasons, and they're already in queue and ready to go. And they're destroying facilities, I think storage hangars, and think we might be able to relocate them out on a gravel road somewhere that would reduce the cost if we were to pay for the movement of those. So I'm wondering if we might incorporate a global recommendation to the federal government that they reevaluate or at least run through a quick check to see if those that are on demolition schedule are actually being done so for life safety reasons versus others, and to see if it still meets the hurdle as far as the risk-reward going forward today.
This is certainly an issue that, as I'm sure you know, the delegations raise consistently, and we have as well with the Air Force. And I think that's a good move to do. The only thing I would offer up, Senator, if I could, is the Air Force will come back and say, well, we're not going to destroy anything if the 18th goes away. And, oh, by the way, the only reason we would do so is because we're trying to meet our Air Force 2020, objectives with regards to reductions of infrastructure and infrastructure costs. It has nothing to do with the mission. It would be simply additional infrastructure unrequired. I'm not saying the Air Force is right, but we will get those kinds of answers. But I think taking it to a global perspective to say, what's the metrics, what's the criteria that you're using for selection of installations or facilities for demolition, and how does that then apply to Eielson, gets to the point that you're trying to face.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, in an earlier life before I was elected, I served on the Nike Site Summit Committee where, working with Senator Stevens, we tried to secure the roof on an existing facility. And right now, the last I met with that particular group, I think I'm looking to my staff, last fall, they were under a signature in a contract that if they didn't complete X, Y, and Z, which meant that they had to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars to secure a few more facilities, that the military, I won't say which, I just can't recall which area was going to come in and was going to demolish those buildings. Well, it's an aggressive schedule. It's been sitting there for a long time. But again, is that a priority in this type of environment where we're losing soldiers and other opportunities?
Agreed.
Access is limited. There's all kinds of things.
Take your point. We'll add this as an action for us to take on, Senator. If I may, just in the interest of time, and I've taken quite a lot of your time already, on the issue of total force, one of the recommendations is that we should take a look at a couple of things. The ability to do distance training, live, collective, and virtual training is something that is done in other states where we link 3 to 4 installations together. I'd like to see us be able to do that. I also believe that there is a huge potential here for the National Guard in the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance world, ISR. And the reason why I think that that's a huge growth area, not only because of the fact that it's being talked a lot, both in terms of the RPAs as well as cyber, but it allows the Air Force to have the Air National Guard, from their perspective, the Air National Guard heavily engaged in contingency operations without having to deploy people overseas, which creates upset within the community. And so these kind of, as they call them, reach-back missions, it's fertile for expansion, and I think we need to make sure that it would be done as an additive mission, not as a in lieu of something we already have. but I do think that's something we need to take a look at and explore.
This seems to be the kind of what I thought the J-Park's wiring was going to allow us. Whose decision is that? What would it take to encourage that, and can the state play a role in that?
That decision would be handled by, well, first of all, it would be executed by DISA, the Defense, Systems Agency. Thank you very much. I knew that I stood for something. Couldn't remember what it was. DISA handles the actual execution, but they have to be tasked by the major commands that oversee the installations. So it would be the Alaskan Command and PACAF on the Air Force side, and from an Army side, it would be U.S. Army Alaska and the Pacific Command. Okay. All right, sir. Slide number 16. Again, we have talked to some of these already, so I think I just talked to all three of them. We've talked about the alternative on Eielson for a second squadron. We've already talked about the issue of an active association for the 168. And again, just make sure we're clear on this. The long pole in the tent is Air Mobility Command, who has to give up people and aircraft to come to Alaska, because when they go from Air Mobility Command, they go to PACAF, so they no longer control those assets anymore. So we have to have a very good, very strong reason, and we have to have their support. With all respect to working the Pentagon, and with all respect to the work that the TAG can do with the Chief of the National Guard Bureau and the Chief of the Air National Guard, Air Mobility Command is where this resides, and that's where we have to address any issues associated there too. And we've already talked a little bit about distributed ground system and RPAs. As we move on, we're getting close to the end, thankfully, for you guys. Number 17, again, these are all modernization issues. I think the only point that I would make is these are issues that the TAG, in conjunction with the delegation, and we with the installation commanders, will work through the delegation. We've already talked about combat rescue helicopter. One that we did not talk about, which I would encourage for us to take a look at, would be to add a synthetic aperture radar on the helicopters they already have here for the search and rescue mission. The nice part about the synthetic aperture radar, which is called SABR, that they have, is that you can literally move it from aircraft to aircraft, so you don't have to have one for each. And I think that gives them a tremendous flexibility for both their military as well as their civilian search and rescue capability.
And actually, just again, what is synthetic aperture radar for those
of us? Synthetic aperture radar, from a layman's, Mr. Chairman, so I'm going to probably get this wrong. There's probably an engineer here that can tell you what it is, but it allows you to look at infrared, heat. Also, you can tune it to be able to look at certain emissions. For an example, if you want to find... you're looking for someone that's making meth or something like that, and their emissions from the building. It also allows you, for an example, to take a look at, it's also has a ground penetrating radar capability, so you can find fissures. So it's a tremendous asset that's used in other states for purposes of being able to see what you don't normally see to the naked eye, whether it's in day night operations or adverse weather conditions. So it's a multi-spectrum kind of analysis.
And not to interrupt your march to the end here, but a lot of these recommendations, I want to ask the question, what does the state do? And I think the answer might be that these are the kinds of requests we should bring to the defense authorities through our collaboration, through the caucus or the coalition, through the frequent meetings of military and civilian leaders, this kind of stuff. Because a lot of these are great suggestions. I'm not sure how we would go about trying to advance this particular point.
What I would do, and I'm going to defer to my leader here, Mr. Pierre, is propose that I could come back with a memo to them to forward to you, which would identify on this list of items, that on this menu of items that we provided, what a state action could be on those items and those that are clearly federal or military items. And then you have those for your consideration and appropriate action as you see fit.
Mr.
Chairman, thank you. And additionally, I think it's a matter of your oversight on our department as well. So as the JAS committee looks at what we do and how we work together, you can say, hey, how are you guys getting involved in this? We know these are priorities you set out. So not only can we identify what are low-hanging fruit as a group, but you can also come back and say, where are you guys at on these different topics?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-Chair, Senator Kelly has a question.
He
does. Very good. I would take this minute briefly to acknowledge the presence of a World War II U.S. Army veteran. Father Norman Elliott is here. Appreciate you, your service in the past and your attention to our future. Thank you very much for being here, sir. Please proceed, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to the closing slides, these are just the mom and apple pie slides. There's nothing really substantive I would indicate here other than obviously it's important that we speak with one voice. It is important that we operate as a enterprise-wide operation from the state of Alaska. We don't always have to agree on everything, but when we do operate, we have to make sure that we're acting as a state in collaboration with each other and avoid any interstate competitions that may or may not occur. We have to be proactive, and we have to regularly engage decision-makers, not just our delegation, but those decision-makers who are outside our delegation. Heavily focused in today's presentation with regards to the Department of Defense. We have Secretary Napolitano coming up, another key player. We cannot lose sight of her. We also need to make sure that we are thinking when we take actions, if I may be so bold as to do so, as to what could the potential implication be for that installation, and do we need to engage them? I go back to the comment earlier about regulatory impacts on installations. In many states and communities, they literally have, for example, a zoning board where the installation engineer or the garrison engineer sits on the zoning board meetings and provides input so that they know that there's not going to be any kind of a conflict. He doesn't have a vote. It's a non-voting member. But that way, at least a kind of level of coordination takes place. I've talked a little bit about the family services and some of the things that are done there. The more that we have the key leaders in the installations involved in local decision-making processes, at least as an inputter of data or an advisor, the better off we are avoiding conflicts downstream. I think I've talked about that probably more than enough. And I cannot stress the importance of being in the Department of Defense's face. Don't just count on the delegation being the ones that are doing it. It's got to be you guys. They need to know that not only do you care, but you understand their issues. You understand their cost issues, and you understand their operational issues. Mm-hmm. And you're not just there as a promoter of the installation and why it's good for you, more importantly, why it's good for the Department of Defense. I would say, Mr. Chairman, I think there's one more slide, but it probably repeats what I've already said. The only other thing I would offer up would be on BRAC, because everybody wants to know about BRAC. As you know, the Department of Defense requested an authorization for a new base realignment enclosure round in 2015. Both the House Armed Services and Senate Armed Services Committees not only did not act positively on that, they both took negative action, indicating that no funds may be used for purposes of a base realignment enclosure in 2015. The Department of Defense is either going to get a BRAC or they're going to get it some other way, which are these four structure adjustments. And as I said, I'm not here to provide any advice to you or endorse one action or the other. I think it's just important that we recognize it. Come BRAC or come four structure, they're going to get to those cuts, and they're going to continue to push hard every year. And so the question becomes which process best enables us to articulate our message, to have situational awareness of what is coming and what the impact is and how valid those arguments are or are not. So I think they're... Rest assured they'll be back if they don't get it this year to ask for a 2017 BRAC, because it'll always be in an off-election year. And I will be curious to see if the 72,000 personnel reduction announced by the Army today has any impact on members or not, because there are going to be a number of members that are going to lose upwards of 1,700 to, I know one installation is going to lose 3,500 people today. And they, at this stage in time, have no course of action other than to get Congress to roll back everything. Or to accept the decisions that have been announced by the department today. With that, I think I've taken plenty of your time and be happy to answer any closing questions.
Oh, thank you very much, Senator Kelly.
I think I will ask a question I was going to ask a moment ago. Mr. Pierre, would you give us, we talked about what recommendations you could give the state for the low-hanging fruit. Would you give us five? Rather than, and I don't mean right now.
Okay.
Give us five. Make sure they do not include the words collaborate or facilitate. Like to see five statute changes, appropriations, or anything we can actually do. So anything else that's just kind of, it's not pie in the sky. All this stuff is valuable that you do and the AMFAS team does, but those things are kind of hard to accomplish, and it's kind of hard to measure their success or failure. Give us a couple of statutes, give us some appropriations, and I'd like to have it actually before the governor goes into his budget determinations. The only reason that is because it allows you to more freely speak. Because we'll support his stuff, I think, it, as far as the military things go. But there may be some things internally that you guys jettison for reasons that you would do in the executive branch. But if you could give us that now, I think that would be valuable.
Understood, and will do. Okay. Thank you very much.
Questions from the committee? Representative Matarra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the Secretary is in town, will there be any opportunities to have engagement with the JAC Committee here at Jackson?
Through the Chair, Representative Tarr, I'm not sure about that. A lot of times these folks are coming through for refueling stops, and I know she's doing a Coast Guard-specific visit. So the Coast Guard just said, hey, we want you to allow us to show her around. And I said, only if we can promote certain things we want to promote with her. So they're agreeing to that, and that's how it goes. So if we ever have a longer period, a longer day where she does come up, I know that we're looking with the Coast Guard to invite her and Admiral Papp to the grand opening of the sector anchorage. That would be an excellent opportunity to work in a meeting with that leadership team.
Senator Fricklaw.
Is there, earlier you had a recommendation for traveling, a delegation to travel to Washington, D.C. Are you looking at dates and times that are more optimum for that travel, and will you be providing specifics on who you think should attend?
Let me answer time frame first, if I could. I would urge that we would take a look at the September-October time frame, and the rationale for September-October is that we will be at the point when the fiscal year 2013 legislative process allegedly comes to a close. I say allegedly because we haven't done that for a number of years yet. But we will have been past the force structure adjustment. We will be near decisions regarding the 18th Aggressor Squadron and other basing actions that may impact Alaska, so it's timely. It's also just as the services have submitted their FY15 budget execution statements to the Defense Comptroller, and the Defense OSD, the Office of Secretary of Defense, will be evaluating what adjustments they want. So this is a good time to be able to impact or plant seeds on decisions that are yet to come, as well as those that are close. In terms of a makeup, again, if I could, Senator, at the risk of, I don't want to, you know, avoid the answer. I think it's really something that you have to decide, but I'll go back to the example I gave before. I think it certainly has to be somebody out of the, you know, either the governor or the lieutenant governor. I think certainly the adjutant general would be welcome. I think community leaders from each of the major installations should be involved, you know, mayors, council members, whatever the case may be. Certainly we need to have some state legislators. And then I know that you have civilian aid, the Secretary of the Army, and a member of the Chief's Civic Leaders Group here as well. Those are the logical people. Specific names, ma'am, I'd have to defer to you, but that gives you at least a sort of a general manifest. I hope that's helpful.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add, thank you again for the record. I'd like to see members of this committee, if not all of you, certain leadership team that you all decide, go with the governor or lieutenant governor or both, to make some of those visits. I think it'd be very impactful.
If I might just supplement, just again, I know I'm taking time here, but I don't want you to come just for the sake of coming too. I mean, when we have you come, we will have identified the issues to cover, who we're going to see. And one of the things that we do in the past, which I think is very productive, is we will develop some draft questions for you to ask of each of the various speakers. We'll go to one conference room and they come to you, so you don't have to run on the Pentagon to find them. And we equally then provide them to the Department of Defense in advance, because we're never going to catch them. They're pretty smart guys. They know what's coming and they know how to talk around them. But by having done so, we all have defined the environment and the issues that we want to talk to, so when we have the conversations, they're going to be pretty productive. I hope that's helpful.
And if members of the committee will indulge me a little bit, we do have Sharon Anderson, the civilian aide to the Secretary of the Air Force here. If you just wave your hands, we all know who you are. I do see Greg Kaplan from Senator Murkowski's office, and Bob Dole from Senator Brakich's office. These are people that will be our liaisons with the congressional delegation, good people to know. And questions, Senator Dyson, and then Darkwa. I'm sorry, you were raising your hand. Go ahead, sir.
I've been reluctant to ask a question. You know, I look at this whole process, it's always uncomfortable when it seems as if our perspective is very parochial and very self-centered. But the issue has been raised, you know, I think really, I'm not sure the decision makers understand all, you know, many of the issues that we have raised. I don't want us to appear to be just another self-interested group lobbying for only their interest. And for DOD particularly, it's got to be the national interest and so on and so forth. And then there's two things I worry about. Are there things that the decision makers don't think about that are so important about Alaska's geographic thing? If you only look at a Mercator projection, you miss it. I'm a mariner. Most people have no idea why a boat going from Seattle goes through the Aleutian Chains going to Japan. I mean, it's spherical geometry. You know, remember 540 degrees and included triangle? That makes it so different. I worry that decision makers don't understand what's happening in the Arctic and Arctic transportation. We have an order of magnitude more traffic through the Bering Sea. If I was a State Department DOD type decision maker, I would say, at least from my perspective, I don't know when there's been a period in the last 30 or 40 years where so many moving pieces in the geopolitical world that can affect the whole world and our hemisphere. You know, it's just, and the day may come with Middle Eastern instability and China, Russia, North Korea rattling their swords or running off at the mouth or whatever, that the commodities that the world depends on, energy, could be interdicted so easily. And Alaska could be, from wherever we're at right now, to right into the center, virtually, of our national and continental security and energy independence. And if I was a decision maker, I'd be saying, let's be careful. Let's go slow at shutting down and dismantling the very, not only facilities, but capacities we may desperately need, you know, in 4 or 5 years. So, I mean, that's a statement. But, and then do the, within the federal bureaucracy, do they talk to each other? And does DOD know, you know, I mean, what Homeland Security's interests might very well be accelerated? We're back having bear bombers probing the edges of our area again. You know, antiques out of, what, 35 years ago? And you know, who knows what's going on with that? NORAD, you know, is reevaluating their whole mission. Do these decision makers understand that? And I'm discouraged that you're nodding. I mean, it's a sad commentary on us. But so if we want to represent the national interest and so on and so forth, it's always embarrassing to go tell people what they already know. You know, it's insulting.
Three quick points, and I will be quick. It's hit and miss on the level of coordination and communication. Sometimes they do. Many times they don't. Part of the reason why our recommendation is to have an independent think tank that is well thought of and respected in Washington to address the strategic importance of Alaska is so it's not us. We, of course, think it's important. We need somebody who is independent from us to validate that importance and to do so in a thoughtful and coherent manner, backed up with empirical data. That's why we suggested on that to have somebody else do it. And lastly, and I think I've said this, but I'm going to repeat it if I didn't, so I'll apologize. The last thing you want to do is go into the Department of Defense and say, boy, JBEAR is great for Alaska, and here's what it does for Alaska. ILSIN is great for folks in the interior, and here's why. It's all about why is it important to you, and maybe here's a point that you've missed in evaluating why it's important to you. So we're here not to critique, but to provide information on why these installations benefit the Department of Defense and to think about the downrange implications if they're not there. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you.
Joe Liston, got a question.
Yeah, very, very good points the senator is making, but, you know, because I spent a lot of time in Hawaii, speaking of the delegation, they do this every year, and it's very, very organized. They send a large group to Washington, and I think it's the Chamber of Commerce that that coordinates that whole effort. But all of the key people from the legislature, from the military departments, and from the city, businesses and whatnot, they go back and they make a very tremendous presentation to the leaders back there. But the point that Fred is making is a message that we probably should convey, you know, to the leaders back there. You know, self-interest is one thing, you know, when we're talking on the BRAC agenda. It can be very self-serving and embarrassing at times. You really need to bring the strategic picture, I think, to the people back there.
Along those lines, I'm going to ask Mr. Hijacking a question. In the course of your research and investigation of the issues, what is the state of civilian and military relations in Alaska? What's the current structure and how well is it working? Are there deficiencies we should plug somehow? Either of you, actually.
So, Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, are you talking about civilian population or civilian employees?
I would say
for DOD.
Civilian authorities, whether the state or the legislature or the community council or chambers of commerce, commanders' councils, just what's the infrastructure of communication right now?
I believe, Mr. Chairman, to answer your question, it's led by the installation, not the other way around. And I think we could improve on a statewide level. I'll give an example. General Hogue, the Alaska Command Commander, has a community advocacy group. I think some of you might be on it or have been on it in the past or have gone to some of the meetings. Mayor Hopkins in Fairbanks does a monthly meeting with the military folks where they all come to his office and the mayors are there and they chat about what's important and try to solve problems. We could do the same thing on a state level and invite folks in and say, hey, let's talk about your issues. Let's talk about what's not working for you and what we need to do to fix it. And it doesn't have to be big moving pieces. Sometimes it can be, you know, statute changes. Other times it's just a matter of making sure that everybody understands that DOT is really important and, the Youth Academy is really important, but geez, we don't like those felons trying to come on and off base all the time. How do we, support all these requirements? So those are just some of the side effects that we can do. I think Florida gave me a great example when I was down there for my first defense communities meeting, and that was commissioners and legislators meet with garrison commanders or base commanders to talk about real issues, not strategic issues, about real issues that can help make life better at the base and help make life better for the community. And that's something that we could do, that you guys could lead.
Question, General Callis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me echo Senator Dyson and General Lesenkoff's comments. Over a decade ago, I joined several of you, I think, back in Washington as a traveling delegation. And as we went to the Pentagon, I naively thought I would see a lot of polar projection maps and a lot of understanding. I did not. The Mercator projection has done more to harm American citizens' understanding of geography than almost anything I can think of. It's horrible. I flew once from Vancouver to Beijing commercially, and I sat beside a Chinese graduate student who said, why are we flying in a curve to China? Mm-hmm. I said, we're not flying in a curve, we're going in a straight line. And I drew her the map. And most Americans, no, I won't exaggerate, a lot of Americans think Alaska is still in the box in the Gulf of California. or Canadian. So do not overassume. The average American, let alone decision makers, understand the national strategic importance of this position. We really have to work on the tools and how we present them. I know General Case held his breath when he flew his active duty fighters across the pole on his watch, exercising this, I think, for the first time in a long time. Applaud you for doing that. Anyway, there we are.
Senator Faircloth has a question. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I wanted to make a recommendation. I was wondering if the two co-chairs of this committee would work with the governor's office to coordinate a delegation that we've been talking about today. If committee members are available, so be it. But then on top of what we've heard in the conversation, I concur with Senator Dyson and all those following remarks about the appropriateness of the conversation, the bullet points, and working with Mr. Pierre and I know Pierre. I get whacked, won't I? to put together a meeting and then do, if we're going to bring people together from, per se, the civilian community, as well as community leaders, we need to have an orchestrated event. And so that requires a pre-event in my estimation prior to flight departure, so that we could actually cue people up and have them ready to go in a presentation to incorporate, as retired Brigadier General Canellis has pointed out, the polar maps, and that should be included so that we can speak to some of those primary advantages of Alaska's strategic importance. And if I could follow up on a note that I have been hesitant to bring forward, and I don't know if it's part of a national conversation, but I did meet with policymakers in Department of Defense, and I asked a question while I was there. I believe it was with NCSL. I was the chairman of Labor and Economic Development, and we were looking at pennies, nickels, and dimes, as all states are doing at this time. And I asked the Department of Defense on their procurement process for acquiring jet fuel. Because I can't give you the numbers now. I could have then, but it would be, it might be for this, the reason I'm bringing it up today, it might be part of this presentation. The military spends an awful lot of money importing oil, and that importation is coming from foreign countries that aren't necessarily kind to us. So they didn't give me that, so maybe we're only importing nationally, at least nationally, federal defense level at non, or maybe at allied forces, I don't know. But when you looked at least several years ago, we were buying only 5% in our portfolio from Venezuela, as an example, but that was more like 80 to 90% of what they were selling. And so we are actually funding governments that weren't friendly to us via this, via production of, and purchase of oil. And so I'm wondering, again, when you go through Mexico and we look at the pipeline of bringing oil into America, it is much more viable and defensible to have oil coming in from Alaska to fill up our strategic reserves, to have those things in place, than the bottleneck that we currently face as a nation elsewhere. And I'm just wondering, and that's from bits and pieces. I've attended Energy Council, and that talked about a pivot point for America. If that particular point were to somehow be compromised, that Americans' access to that oil would be to the detriment of all of us. And so I'm wondering if that's part of the conversation, their procurement practice. I did not dig any deeper. They did not want to go there. They had their procedures and policies in place, and they were going to fulfill those contracts. I didn't see where those contracts are being purchased from. But again, if we were purchasing American versus some of these foreign nationals, as long as the trade balance, I know there's so much more that Congress has to take into account as well as the Department of Defense does, but are we looking at any of that? It seems like Alaska has the potential to be that foundation for America when it comes to crude, and understanding that as far as I know, we don't have a lot of options to fly jets beside jet fuel.
And to that point, after your comment.
Very briefly, I think I would. The short answer would be the Department of Defense will say we have full and open competition, and we'll take fuel from wherever we can get at the right price with the managed risk and so on. They'll have a standard answer. I think this is a, if I could be so bold, a delegation issue, that they are going to be better positioned to work than a delegation coming from the state of Alaska meeting with the Department of Defense. I would also say you've got two sort of tectonic plate issues here. You've got this energy issue, both in terms of oil sources and the cost of energy in Alaska. But one of the other ones that we've talked about a lot is the strategic importance of Alaska. And I think if I was going to focus us on one aspect for the first trip there, I would suggest that we need to focus on that. And again, at the risk of taking too much time, Mr. Chairman, I just went through something similar in Luke Air Force Base, where we secured the F-35 training mission. But the very first year that I started working with them, it took us 5 years to turn this battleship around. The instant reaction from the Air Force was, Luke Air Force Base, that's Phoenix. Man, there's so much congestion there. Why would we put the Joint Strike Fighter there? And it's because it's a growth area. Well, they had very, very carefully managed growth. So we took encroachment, flipped it on its head, showed it to be managed growth that was growth but was all compatible with the installation and the role that they played, and we showed all the state legislative legislation that was passed, local ordinances and so on. And by the time we got done, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force said, let me talk to you about managed growth at Luke Air Force Base. We're going to have to turn that battleship around as well here, and I think that's why I would, if I could be so bold, recommend that would be a focus we have for the first visit.
For members, just logistically, I think we should probably wrap it up by 3:30. We started a little bit late, and I don't know if people have a busy schedule, but just out of respect for people's obligations, with that. If you want to follow up and then Representative Isaacson.
Mr. Chairman, I just was going to say that it's probably better for our federal delegation to take on. We're asking for a positive outcome for some specific actions that the federal government may or may not take. I'm happy to take it off the table and leave it to the congressional delegation, but it's an issue, and it's a very sensitive issue, and the DOD is very closed about having that conversation, at least to this layman. And you know, I was elected, but that's not someone inside of DOD.
And to that point, actually, I think we will take up with the co-chairs about trying to select a delegation to do what we can, because I think some communication on the issues you outlined would be good. So we will pick that up. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that, actually, it's something that should be discussed in here, because even though it might not be the global aspect about where energy comes from, it does bear to the value of Eielson. We have 20 million gallons of jet fuel, and where does it come from? It is the cheapest logistical transportation in the whole Air Force system. It comes from a little refinery that most people don't even know about in North Pole called Petrostar. And they've got the contract, and it is piped from the Trans-Alaska pipeline through Flint Hills and Petrostar, and then it's piped directly to Eielson. So for basing more aircraft and more mission at Eielson, it just makes sense. And increasing associated units and so forth, it just makes sense. Eielson is strategic to the national interest because it is at the top of the world, you know, the place where fuel is readily accessible. And that can't be overstressed, and for the sake of time, I'll just keep my comment to that. But that's one of our points. And definitely in drawing up this team, also to get the question and answers, I would ask that, and I'm sure you will, just go back through the volumes of work that's been done in the couple years that the Tiger team has been meeting, and we've hashed so much of this in the year that's passed. I'm sure there's been more, but all of this is great stuff. I'll stop, because I'm about to get excited, and the preacher doesn't know when to land the plane.
All right. I have Representative Tarr and then Senator Faircloth, and then I'm going to call on somebody else here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We kind of breezed over those last pages that were military personnel quality of life, and some of them were around spouses and dependents, but the issue of veterans didn't come up at all, and that we have the highest number of veterans per capita, and that I would imagine is only expected to increase as time goes on. So does that have any impact in decision-making at the federal level in terms of facility closure or anything like that? Or how, you know, that can that be to our advantage at all in that conversation?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, McHugh again, Representative Tarr, that's a great question, because that's something we've brought up as the EIS public comments have been taking place, because we have veterans who utilize health facilities that are at the bases that could potentially be shut down if certain troops leave. So how do those veterans get care? And that increases the cost of the VA. The short answer is no. That's not part of it. Our strategic military engagement is separate from our veterans plan, only in that our veterans plan is a more hands-on, smaller scale grassroots effort. I say that, but at the same time, our veterans director, Verdi Bowen, for the state of Alaska, does a phenomenal job. He meets with Secretary Shinseki quarterly. Secretary Shinseki has tried to steal in from us multiple times, and that hasn't happened yet, so we must be doing something right here in Alaska. But we are tracking that as an organization, as a state, and I think we're doing a phenomenal job. And you guys have been a big help in that, a big player, so we appreciate it.
Thank you. Senator Birkhoff?
Thank you. On that point, it certainly would be under the strategies that we wanted to have a delegation go back and talk about the importance of community and how this community as well as the state support our military personnel, that would be an item in our presentation where we talked about, because of how Alaska embraces its military families, we could list all the services as well as pieces of legislation that we do on a continuing basis to renew that commitment annually. and then bring in that veteran component to try to support whatever strategies we might bring forward. And then back on Representative Isaacson's comment, I don't mean that we shouldn't talk about it at all, nor that it's not relevant for this committee, but that we make our best showing that we can in choosing whether we want to advocate for a BRAC. Maybe we don't want to advocate for a BRAC, but if that's the transparent process that gives us more open debate versus an internal bureaucracy making a decision without us, then maybe we want our congressional delegation to know that we may support a formalized process versus an informal, I think you said,
Good question. I'm with you, though.
Restructuring process, a forced restructuring process. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I want to give some folks a good answer.
I just had one more point, Mr. Chairman, for Senator Faircloth about procurement. Through shared services, we can lower the procurement costs of the military here. One of the issues that we specifically brought up is that GVEA, for example, through Mayor Hopkins' meetings, has said, hey, we buy coal for $3, you know, a BTU essentially, and the Air Force said, well, at Eielson, we buy it for $8. So we can save, you know, $5 right there, and that's over a lot of coal. So just for the procurement side of that. Thank you.
I want to give General Case the opportunity to ask questions. I know you kindly sat in the audience. Do you have any questions you want to get on mic for, sir?
Mr. Chairman, specifically regarding General Case's comment about the Arctic, I would be remiss if I didn't share with you guys Stephanie Moreland in the governor's office is leading the Arctic issues from the executive branch perspective, working closely. I know Representative Herron, and I believe you have a senator who's the co-chair, I think it's Senator McGuire, I'm not quite sure, on the Arctic policy issues. But we've been having a number of meetings about how decisions are made by the D.C. bureaucracy and how they have a hard time getting over the Rocky Mountain as far as communications are concerned, and letting them understand that we are the reason the United States is an Arctic nation. So a White House policymaker who is leading the discussions there on the Arctic was recently up here, and Stephanie was having some serious discussions with that person as well as the commissioners, and I'm not sure if the governor met with them or not, but there's a clear focus to make sure that we have a voice and that decisions are clearly made in D.C. regarding the Arctic and us.
I want to give the representatives online the chance to chime in. Representative Feinger, Representative Hughes, you're online. Do you have any questions or comments?
No questions.
Okay, and how about Colonel Jones? Do you have any questions or comments in Fairbanks?
No, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'll go to Senator Coghill and then Senator Kelly.
Thank you. Three things, and one to McHugh first. On the recommendation for independent CSIS review, is that something that the governor's already headed down the road on? Is that something that we need to back up? Is there something that we can help with?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, the short answer is no. We haven't taken it to that level yet.
The top priority, in my view. That should be one of the first things we do, because if we're not going to be self-serving, we have to have somebody tell us what we really have. So I think that should be top priority as we come out of this committee. Secondly, on the active association, this goes to Mr. Fairham, the new dynamic of having the reserves be more active in enforcement, in deployment, and in support. Does Alaska have any advantages that we can highlight in that account?
Well, I would say that the 168th mission, because of the fact that it supports Pacific Air Bridge to the north and the fact that it supports any Tier 1 missions, for example, the President's transiting the Pacific Ocean, the type of mission is a big plus. Therefore, again, we come back to geography as an asset. Beyond that, nothing, frankly, leaps at a fore right now that I can think of.
So the question I'm going to ask is, what can we do to help, say, our Air Guard make that more attractive? So that's a question we don't have to answer today, but that's a question I'll be looking for an answer to. And then the other thing is, Canada also does the SARs on the Arctic. What's our cooperation in DOD? Is there something that we can do better as a state?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, this is McHugh again for the record. There's nothing we can do better. We are DOD's Arctic search and rescue effort. We coordinate with Canada on a weekly basis. We do joint missions with them. We've exercised with them as recently as this winter. We practiced a 737 crash near Bethel where we deployed our conceptual Arctic response kit, which you can drop out of a C-17, which is not traditionally a search and rescue asset, but because we know we have the space and we have the need to house people in an Arctic condition, that we had to utilize that piece of equipment.
So then the question is, if we're going to back east to D.C., is that a sparkling gem we need to polish up and make sure everybody knows? Is that something that we should have as an asset put forward, or is it a cost that we're just growing under?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I think we need to come back and give you some more details, but I would say this up front. That's a NORTHCOM issue, Northern Command issue out of Colorado Springs. So as far as the Pentagon itself is concerned, they aren't as impressed with our search and rescue efforts because they see that more of a civilian need and a State Department concern. So that's just one thing to consider.
And that brought me to my last thing, and that is we need to understand I made a note here, I'm sorry. You said that we had the Air Mobility Command issue. I guess one of the things we need to know as a committee is making sure we're not barking up the wrong tree. So when we go back, we need to be able to not only articulate to Pentagon, but we need to know who we're talking to. And the Air Mobility Command obviously is something that I personally have missed as far as an important factor. So,
sir, Air Mobility Command is a decision authority with regards to the approval of the active association and the allocation of equipment. They coordinate with Headquarters Air Force, what's called the A1, the personnel shop. So it's a shared decision, but it's driven by Air Mobility Command. We would definitely want to talk with them. It may not be necessarily in conjunction with a D.C. visit, but it's certainly a place that we need to visit, as we've talked about with PAC.
Because of our asset as a National Guard and our air bridge capacity, that is something we need to make sure that we visit on in a huge way. So,
indeed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Kelly.
McHugh, would you check for me, please? I know, we have an incredibly talented group of people through AMFAST that understand and have relationships at a pretty deep level with people in the Pentagon. We talked a little earlier that the Pentagon, or at least the military, is arctically challenged. They don't quite get us. But there are a lot of people in the Pentagon who have served in Alaska. And I know, General Case, I believe you're on AMFAST, and General Ralston, the list goes on. If we could identify some of those people in the Pentagon before we go down there, it's a preparation before we go down there, who are the Alaskan people that reside currently in the Pentagon, whether they're counting beans or making strategic decisions, doesn't matter, because it's obvious these discussions and decisions are being made both by accountants and strategy folks. So if you could provide us a pretty good list that I'm sure the AMFAS folks could give you of exactly it is who we need to maybe start developing some long-term relationships with the Pentagon, who have Alaskan experience.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelly, we have two people right away that come to mind, General Troy and then the Great Eagle General. I keep on forgetting his name. Both USARAC commanders. And, so they were two stars here. And General Garrett was who I was thinking of. And they're both three and four-star up-and-comers. So, I mean, they're decision-makers in the Pentagon, and those are folks that we need to take advantage of.
Hey, did Case retire, or did he go up to a four-star, or is he still... Not Cash, Dean Cash. Do you know? Whatever happened to Cash?
He retired.
He retired? Oh, he is?
Good deal. Well, this is a good discussion. I kind of hate to chop it off, but it has been 2.5 hours, and I would say that's a great presentation, and as the General said, it does lay out an agenda that will take a lot of hard work to follow through on, so we should look at this as the first of many such meetings. We are working to schedule another JASC meeting in about 2 weeks in Fairbanks, the week of July 8th, likely the 11th or 12th. We should get with my staffer, Kim Skipper, to work out details while we're all here to see what works best for people. That would be before the public hearings scheduled on the draft EIS for ILSEN, which is July 15th through 19th.
We've been kicking around ideas for the agenda for this next meeting. I'm going to briefly tick off what I think they could be done and entertain suggestions for that. First, what are the low-hanging fruit we spoke of? What can the legislature do in the next session to address some of these short-term recommendations? An update from Mr. Pierre, Mr. Mayor Hopkins, myself, and others who attended the Defense Communities Association meeting in Washington to share more about the shared services agreements and joint land use agreements, that kind of stuff, to bring back the experts from D.C. I would like to have a presentation from the mayor and Representative Isaacson and other people in Fairbanks about their efforts to defend Isles and some of the strategies have been successful, just make sure we all know what they're doing. Another topic is what are the long-term actions that the legislature should take up going forward, which is going to be largely the things you recommend in this report, Mr. Hijack. I'd like to approve updated comments on the Allison EIS. The final comments are due the end of July, so we have some time, but it's important for us to go on the record with clear fact-supported declarations there. And we're also hoping to set up a tour of Allison, and that may or may not happen, but we're going to work on that, and we'll let you know through email or phone calls as soon as we know that. With that, other questions or comments, Representative Tarr, and wrap up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things. U.S. Army Alaska Legislative Day tomorrow at Jay Pierce.
That's right.
Just as a reminder for folks, hopefully they're going. And then also, perhaps, why I brought up the Secretary's visit was just because of the Arctic strategies and importance, and to my knowledge, this would be the first visit, and that I would imagine is a topic of conversation that maybe we could get a report back on at that next meeting.
Okay, good. Take note of that. And also, I assume a lot of us are going to run to the Google to quickly find out what the PEA results are for Alaska's Army, the BCT. So that's what I'll be going to quickly thereafter. Sir, go ahead.
You provided that earlier.
Sir. Oh, you did. Okay, we do have that, I guess. Other wrap-up comments? With that, I want to thank members of the committee for your patience and for your good questions, to our witness for giving us just the right amount of information, and to the audience for sitting with us. And with no other business coming before us now, it is now 3:37. We are adjourned.